He hopped off his stool and gave his mother a hug, which was un-Alethi, but Dalinar suffered the behavior. Then he was out the door. Evie stepped up to the fire.
So cold. What possessed someone to build a fortress way up here?
It's not that bad, Dalinar said. You should visit the Frostlands in a season of winter.
You Alethi cannot understand cold. Your bones are frozen.
Dalinar grunted his response, then leaned down over the map.
I'll need to approach from the south, march up along the lake's coast.
The king is sending a message via Spanreet, Evie noted. It's being scribed now.
Her accent is fading, Dalinar noticed absently.
When she sat down in a chair by the fire, she supported herself with her right hand, safe hand, tucked demurely against her waist. She kept her blonde hair in Alethi braids, rather than letting it tumble about her shoulders. She'd never be a great scribe. She didn't have the youthful training and art and letters of a Vorin woman. Besides, she didn't like books, and preferred her meditations. But she'd tried hard these last years, and he was impressed. She still complained that he didn't see Renarin enough. The other son was unfit for battle and spent most of his time in Kolinar. Evie spent half the year back with him.
No, no, Dalinar thought, writing a glyph on the map. The coast is the expected route.
What then? An amphibious assault across the lake? He'd need to see if he could get ships for that. A scribe eventually entered, bearing the king's letter, and everyone but Dalinar and Evie left. Evie held the letter and hesitated.
Do you want to sit, or...
No. Go ahead.
Evie cleared her voice.
Brother, the letter began, the treaty is sealed. Your efforts in Yakaved are to be commended, and this should be a time of celebration and congratulations. Indeed, on a personal note, I wish to express my pride in you. The word from our best generals is that your tactical instincts have matured to full-fledged strategic genius. I never counted myself among their ranks, but to a man they commend you as their equal. As I have grown to become a king, it seems you have found your place as our general. I'm most interested to hear your own reports of the small mobile team tactics you've been employing. I would like to speak in person at length about all of this. Indeed, I have important revelations of my own I would like to share. It would be best if we could meet in person. Once I enjoyed your company every day. Now I believe it has been 3 years since we last spoke face to face.
But, Dalinar said, interrupting, the rift needs to be dealt with.
Evie broke off, looking at him, then back down at the page. She continued reading.
Unfortunately, our meeting will have to wait a few storms longer. Though your efforts on the border have certainly helped solidify our power, I have failed to dominate Rathalas and its renegade leader with politics. I must send you to the Rift again. You are to quell this faction. Civil war could tear Alethkar to shreds, and I dare not wait any longer. In truth, I wish I'd listened when we spoke so many years ago, and you challenged me to send you to the Rift. Sadeas will gather reinforcements and join you. Please send word of your strategic assessment of the problem. Be warned. We are certain now that one of the other High Princes, we don't know who, is supporting Tanalon and his rebellion. He may have access to shards. I wish you strength of purpose and the Herald's own blessings in your new task. With love and respect, Gavilar.
Ebi looked up.
How did you know? Dalinar, you've been poring over those maps for weeks, maps of the Crown Lands and of Alethkar. You knew he was going to assign you this task.
What kind of strategist would I be if I couldn't foresee the next battle?
I thought we were going to relax, Evie said. We were going to be done with the killing.
With the momentum I have, what a waste that would be. If not for this problem in Rathalas, Gavilar would have found somewhere else for me to fight. Herdaz again, perhaps. You can't have your best general sitting around collecting creme.
Besides, there would be men and women among Gavilar's advisers who worried about Dalinar. If anyone was a threat to the throne, it would be the Blackthorn, particularly with the respect he'd gained from the kingdom's generals. Though Dalinar had decided years ago that he would never do such a thing, many at court would think the kingdom safer if he were kept away.
"No, Evie," he said as he made another notation. "I doubt we will ever settle back in Kolinar again."
He nodded to himself. That was the way to get to the rift. One of his mobile bands could round and secure the lake's beach. He could move the entire army across it then, attacking far faster than the rift expected. Satisfied, he looked up and found Evie crying. The sight stunned him, and he dropped his pencil. She tried to hold it back, turning toward the fire and wrapping her arms around herself, but the sniffles sounded as distinct and disturbing as breaking bones. Kalek's breath. He could face soldiers and storms, falling boulders and dying friends, but nothing in his training had ever prepared him to deal with these soft tears.
7 years, she whispered. 7 years we've been out here, living in wagons and waystops. 7 years of murder, of chaos, of men crying to their wounds.
You married?
Yes, I married a soldier. It's my fault for not being strong enough to deal with the consequences. Thank you, Dalinar. You've made that very clear.
This was what it was like to feel helpless.
I thought you were growing to like it. You now fit in with the other women?
The other women? Dalinar, they make me feel stupid.
But
conversation is a contest to them, Evie said, throwing her hands up. Everything has to be a contest with you, Alethi, always trying to show up everyone else. For the women, it's this awful unspoken game to prove how witty they each are. I've thought maybe the only answer to make you proud is to go to the Night Watcher and ask for the blessing of intelligence. The old magic can change a person, make something great of them.
Evie, Dalinar cut in, please, don't speak of that place or that creature. It's blasphemous.
You say that, Dalinar, she said, but no one actually cares about religion here. Oh, they make sure to point out how superior their beliefs are to mine. But who actually ever worries about the heralds, other than to swear by their names? You bring Ardens to battle merely to soul cast rocks into grain. That way you don't have to stop killing each other long enough to find something to eat.
Dalinar approached, then settled down into the other seat by the hearth.
It is different in your homeland?
She rubbed her eyes, and he wondered if she'd see through his attempt to change the subject. Talking about her people often smoothed over their arguments.
Yes, she said. True, there are those who don't care about the One or the Heralds. They say we shouldn't accept Irialli or Boren doctrines as our own. But Dalinar, many do care. Here, you just pay some Arden to burn glyph wards for you and call it done.
Dalinar took a deep breath and tried again.
Perhaps, after I've seen to the rebels, I can persuade Gavilar not to give me another assignment. We could travel, go west, to your homeland.
So you could kill my people instead?
No, I wouldn't.
They'd attack you, Dalinar. My brother and I are exiles, if you haven't forgotten.
He hadn't seen Toe in a decade, ever since the man had gone to Herdas. He reportedly liked it quite well, living on the coast, protected by Alethi bodyguards. Evie sighed.
I'll never see the sunken forests again. I've accepted that. I will live my life in this harsh land, so dominated by wind and cold.
Well, we could travel someplace warm, up to the steam water, just you and I, time together. We could even bring Adolin.
And Renarin?
Evie asked.
Dalinar, you have 2 sons, in case you have forgotten. Do you even care about the child's condition?
Or is he nothing to you now that he can't become a soldier?
Dalinar grunted, feeling like he'd taken a mace to the head. He stood up, then walked toward the table.
What?
Evie demanded.
I've been in enough battles to know when I've found one I can't win.
So you flee?
Evie said.
Like a coward?
The coward, Dalinar said, gathering his maps, is the man who delays a necessary retreat for fear of being mocked. We'll go back to Kolinar after I deal with the rebellion at the Rift. I'll promise you at least a year there.
Really?
Evie said, standing up.
Yes. You've won this fight.
I don't feel like I've won.
Welcome to war, Evie, Dalinar said, heading toward the door. There are no unequivocal wins, just victories that leave fewer of your friends dead than others.
He left and slammed the door behind him. Sounds of her weeping chased him down the steps, and shame spren fell around him like flower petals.
Storms, I don't deserve that woman, do I?
Well, so be it. The argument was her fault, as were the repercussions. He stomped down the steps to find his generals and continue planning his return assault on the Rift.
Shallan's Sketchbook, Kolinar Spren. The Pain Spren in Kolinar are a sickly green color, with long claws and oddly distorted proportions, even more than usual. They respond to pain as readily as ever. Shame Spren have transformed from their usual manifestations as falling blossoms to shards of broken glass. The sense of embarrassment itself appears unaffected. Curiously, the hunger Spren appear to be unchanged. 67. Mishim. This generation has had only one bondsmith, and some blame the divisions among us upon this fact. The true problem is far deeper. I believe that honor himself is changing. From Drawer 2418, Smokestone. A day after being murdered in a brutal fashion, Shallan found that she was feeling much better. The sense of oppression had left her, and even her horror seemed distant. What lingered was that single glimpse she'd seen in the mirror, a glimmer of the unmaid's presence beyond the plane of the reflection. The mirrors in the tailor's shop didn't show such proclivities. She had checked every one. Just in case, she'd given a drawing of the thing she'd seen to the others and warned them to watch. Today she strolled into the little kitchen which was beside the rear workroom. Adolin ate flat bread and curry, while King Elokar sat at the room's table, earnestly writing something? No, he was drawing. Shallan rested fond fingers on Adolin's shoulder and enjoyed his grin in response. Then she rounded to peek over the king's shoulder. He was doing a map of the city, with the palace and the Oathgate platform. It wasn't half bad. Anyone seen the bridgeman? Elokar asked. Here, Kaladin said, strolling in from the workroom. Yokska, her husband, and her maid were out shopping for more food, using spheres that Elokar had provided. Food was apparently still for sale in the city, if you had the spheres to pay. I, Elokar said, have devised a plan for how to proceed in this city. Shallan shared a look with Adolin, who shrugged. What do you suggest, Your Majesty? Thanks to the Lightweaver's excellent reconnaissance, the king said, it is evident my wife is being held captive by her own guards. We don't know that for certain, Your Majesty, Kaladin said. It sounded like the queen has succumbed to whatever is affecting the guards. Either way, she is in need of rescue, Elokar said. Either we must sneak into the palace for her and little Gavinor, or we must rally a military force to help us capture the location by strength of arms. He tapped his map of the city with his pen. The Oathgate, however, remains our priority. Brightness Devar, I want you to investigate this cult of moments. Find out how they're using the Oathgate platform. Yokska had confirmed that each night, some members of the cult set a blazing fire on top of the platform. They guarded the place all hours of the day. If you could join whatever ritual or event they are performing, the king said, you would be within feet of the Oath Gate. You could transport the entire plateau to Urethiru and let our armies there deal with the cult. In case that is not viable, Adolin and I, in the guise of important Light Eyes from the Shattered Plains, shall contact the light-eyed houses in the city who maintain private guard forces. We shall gather their support, perhaps revealing our true identities, and put together an army for assaulting the palace if needed. And me? Kaladin asked. I don't like the sound of this Azure person. See what you can find out about him and his wall guard. Kaladin nodded, then grunted. It's a good plan, Elokar. Adolin said. Nice work. A simple compliment probably should not have made a king beam like it did. Elokar even drew a glory spren, and notably it didn't seem different from ordinary ones. But there is something we have to face, Adolin continued. Have you listened to the list of charges that Ardent, the one who got executed, made against the queen?
Yes.
10 glyphs, Adolin said, denouncing Aesudan's excess. Wasting food while people starved, increasing taxes, then throwing lavish parties for her Ardens. Elokar, this started long before the Everstorm.
We can
ask her, the king said. Once she is safe. Something must have been wrong. Aesudan was always proud and always ambitious, but never gluttonous. He eyed Adolin. I know that Yasna says I shouldn't have married her, that Aesudan was too hungry for power. Yasna never understood. I needed Aesudan, someone with strength. He took a deep breath, then stood up. We mustn't waste time. The plan. Do you agree with it?
I like it, Shallan said.
Kaladin nodded.
It's too general, but it's at least a line of attack. Additionally, we need to trace the grain in the city. Yokska says the Light Eyes provide it, but she also says the palace stores are closed.
You think someone has a soulcaster? Adolin asked.
I think this city has too many secrets, Kaladin said.
Adolin and I shall ask the Light Eyes and see if they know, Elokar said, then looked to Shallan.
The Cult of Moments?
I'll get on it, she said. I need a new coat, anyway.
She slipped out of the building again as Vale. She wore the trousers and her coat, though that now had a hole in the back. Ishna had been able to wash the blood off, but Vale still wanted to replace it. For now, she covered the hole with a light weaving. Vale sauntered down the street, and found herself feeling increasingly confident. Back in Urethiru, she'd still been struggling to get her coat on straight, so to speak. She winced as she thought of her trips through the bars, making a fool of herself. You didn't need to prove how much you could drink in order to look tough, but that was the sort of thing you couldn't learn without wearing the coat, living in it. She turned toward the market, where she hoped to get a feel for Kolinar's people. She needed to know how they fought before she could begin to understand how the Cult of Moments had come to be, and therefore how to infiltrate it. This market was very different from those at Urethiru, or the night markets of Karbranth. First off, this one was obviously ancient. These worn, weathered shops felt like they'd been here for the first desolation. These were stones smoothed by the touch of a million fingers, or indented by the press of thousands of passing feet, awnings bleached by the progression of day after day. The street was wide and not crowded. Some stalls were empty, and the remaining merchants didn't shout at her as she passed. These seemed effects of the smothered sensation everyone felt, the feeling of a city besieged. Yokska served only men, and Vale wouldn't have wanted to reveal herself to the woman anyway. So she stopped at a clothier and tried on some new coats. She chatted with the woman who ran the accounts, her husband was the actual tailor, and got some suggestions on where to look for a coat matching her current one, then stepped back out onto the street. Soldiers in light blue patrolled here, the glyphs on their uniforms proclaiming them to be of House Velalant. Yokska had described their Bright Lord as a minor player in the city until so many light eyes had vanished into the palace. Vale shivered, remembering the line of corpses. Adolin and Elikar were fairly certain those were the remnants of a distant Kolin and his attendants, a man named Kavies, who had often tried to gain power in the city. Neither were sad to see him go, but it whispered of a continuing mystery. More than 30 people had gone to meet with the queen, many more powerful than Kavies. What had happened to them? She passed an assortment of vendors peddling the usual range of necessities and curiosities, from ceramics to dining wares to fine knives. It was nice to see that here the soldiers had imposed some semblance of order. Perhaps rather than fixating on the closed stalls, Vale should have appreciated how many were still open. The third clothing shop finally had a coat she liked, of the same style as her old one, white and long, past her knees. She paid to have it taken in, then casually asked the seamstress about the city's grain. The answers led her one street over to a grain station. It had formerly been a Thalen bank, with the words "Secure Keeps" across the top in Thalen and the women's script. The proprietors had long ago fled. Moneylenders seemed to have a sixth sense for impending danger, the way some animals could sense a storm hours before it arrived. The soldiers in light blue had appropriated it, and the vaults now protected precious grain. People waited in line outside, and at the front, soldiers doled out enough lavis for one day's flatbread and gruel. It was a good sign, if a distinct and terrible reminder of the city situation. She would have applauded Velalant's kindness, save for his soldiers' blatant incompetence. They shouted at everyone to stay in line, but didn't do anything to enforce the order. They did have a scribe watching to make sure nobody got in line twice, but they didn't exclude people who were obviously too well-to-do to need the handout. Vale glanced around the market and noted people watching from the crannies and hollows of abandoned stalls. The poor and unwanted, those destitute beyond even the refugees. Tattered clothing, dirty faces. They watched, like spren drawn by a powerful emotion. Vale settled down on a low wall beside a drainage trough. A boy huddled nearby, watching the line with hungry eyes. One of his arms ended in a twisted, unusable hand, three fingers mere nubs, the other two crooked. She fished in her trouser pocket. Shallan didn't carry food, but Vale knew the importance of having something to chew on. She could have sworn she'd tucked something in while getting ready. There it was. A meat stick. Soul cast, but flavored with sugar. Not quite large enough to be a sausage. She bit off an end, then wagged the rest toward the urchin. The boy sized her up, probably trying to determine her angle. Finally, he crept over and took the offering, quickly stuffing the whole thing into his mouth. He waited, eyeing her to see if she had more. "Why don't you get in line?" Vale asked. "They got rules. Gotta be a certain age. And if you're too poor, they shove you out of the line." "For what reason?" The boy shrugged. "Don't need one, I guess. They say you've already been through, except you haven't." "Many of those people, they're servants from wealthy homes, aren't they?" The urchin nodded. Storming light eyes, Vale thought as she watched. Some of the poor were shoved out of line for one infraction or another, as the urchin had claimed. The others waited patiently, as it was their job. They'd been sent by wealthy homes to collect food. Many bore the lean, strong look of house guards, though they didn't wear uniforms. Storms. Velalant's men really had no idea how to do this. Or maybe they know exactly what they're doing, she thought. And Velalant is just keeping the local Light Eyes happy and ready to support his rule, should the winds turn his way. It made Vale sick. She fished out a second meat stick for the urchin, then started to ask him how far Velalant's influence reached, but the kid was gone in a heartbeat. The grain distribution ended, and a lot of unhappy people called out in despair. The soldiers said they'd do another handout in the evening, and counseled people to line up and wait. Then the bank closed its doors. But where did Velalant get the food? Vale rose and continued through the market, passing pools of angerspren. Some looked like the normal pools of blood. Others were more like tar, pitch black. When the bubbles in these popped, they showed a burning red within, like embers. Those vanished as people settled down to wait, and exhaustion spren appeared instead. Her optimism about the market evaporated. She passed crowds milling about, looking lost, and read depression in people's eyes. Why try to pretend life could go on? They were doomed. The Voidbringers were going to rip this city apart, if they didn't simply let everyone starve. Someone needed to do something. Vale needed to do something. Infiltrating the cult of moments suddenly seemed too abstract. Couldn't she do something directly for these poor people? Except, she hadn't even been able to save her own family. She had no idea what Moraes had done with her brothers, and she refused to think about them. How would she save an entire city? She shouldered through the crowd, seeking freedom, suddenly feeling trapped. She needed out. What was that sound? Shallan pulled up short, turning. Hearing. Storms. It couldn't be. Could it? She drifted toward the sound. That voice. You say that, my dear man, it proclaimed. But everyone thinks they know the moons. How could they not? We live beneath their gaze each night. We've known them longer than our friends, our wives, our children. And yet... Shallan pushed through the milling crowd to find him sitting on the low wall around a storm cistern. A metal brazier burned before him, emitting thin lines of smoke that twisted in the wind. He was dressed, strangely, in a soldier's uniform, Sadius's livery, with the coat unbuttoned and a colored scarf around his neck. The Traveler. The one they called the King's Wit. Angular features. A sharp nose. Hair that was stark black. He was here. There are still stories to tell. Wit leaped to his feet. Few people were paying attention. To them, he was just another busker. Everyone knows that Mishim is the cleverest of the three moons. Though her sister and brother are content to reign in the sky, gracing the lands below with their light, Mishim is always looking for a chance to escape her duty. Wit tossed something into the brazier, producing a bright green puff of smoke, the color of Mishim, the third and slowest of the moons. This story takes place during the days of Tsa, Wit continued, the grandest queen of Natanatan before that kingdom's fall. Blessed with grand poise and beauty, the Natan people were famous across all of Roshar. Why, if you'd lived back then, you'd have viewed the East as a place of great culture, not an empty wasteland. Queen Tsa, as you've doubtless heard, was an architect. She designed high towers for her city, built to reach ever upward, grasping toward the sky. One night, Tsa rested in her greatest tower, enjoying the view. So it was that Mishim, that clever moon, happened to pass in the sky close by. It was a night when the moons were large, and these, everyone knows, are nights when the moons pay special attention to the actions of mortals. "Great Queen," Mishim called. "You build such fine towers in your grand city. I enjoy viewing them each night as I pass." Wit dropped powder into the brazier, this time in clumps that caused two lines of smoke, one white, one green, to stream upward. Shallan stepped forward, watching the smoke curl. The market-goers slowed and began to gather. "Now," Wit said, thrusting his hands into the smoke lines, twisting them so that the smoke swirled and contorted, giving the sense of a green moon spinning in the center. "Queen Tsa was hardly ignorant of Mishim's crafty ways. The Natans were never fond of Mishim, but rather revered the great gnomon. Still, one does not ignore a moon." "Thank you, great celestial one," Tsa called. "Our engineers labor ceaselessly to erect the most splendid of mortal accomplishments." "Almost they reach to my domain," Mishim called. "One wonders if you are trying to obtain it." "Never, great celestial one. My domain is this land, and the sky is yours." Wit thrust his hand high in his smoke, drawing the line of white into the shape of a straight pillar. His other hand swirled a pocket of green above it, like a whirlpool, a tower, and a moon. "That can't be natural, can it?" Shallan thought. "Is he light-weaving?" Yet she saw no stormlight. There was something more organic about what he did. She couldn't be completely certain it was supernatural. "As always, Mishim was hatching a scheme. She loathed being hung in the sky each night, far from the delights of the world below and the pleasures that only mortals know. The next night, Mishim again passed Queen Tsa in her tower. 'It is a pity,' Mishim said, 'that you cannot see the constellations from up close, for they are truly beautiful gemstones, shaped by the finest of gem cutters.' 'It is a pity,' Tsa said, 'but all know that the eyes of a mortal would burn to see such a lofty sight.' On the next night, Mishim tried again. 'It is a pity,' she said, 'that you cannot converse with the star spren as they tell delightsome stories.' 'It is a pity,' Tsa agreed, 'but everyone knows that the language of the heavens would drive a mortal mad.' The next night, Mishim tried a third time. 'It is a pity that you cannot see the beauty of your kingdom from above, for the pillars and domes of your city are radiant.' 'It is a pity,' Tsa agreed, 'but those sights are meant for the great ones of heaven, and to behold them myself would be blasphemous.' Wit dropped another powder into the brazier, bringing up yellow-gold smoke. By now, dozens of people had gathered to watch. He swept his hands to the sides, sending the smoke spraying out in a flat plain. Then it crept upward again in lines, forming towers. A city? He continued to swirl with one hand, drawing the green smoke up into a ring that, with a thrust of his hand, he sent spinning across the top of the yellow-golden city. It was remarkable, and Shallan found her jaw dropping. This was an image that lived. Wit glanced to the side where he'd put his pack. He started, as if surprised. Shallan cocked her head as he quickly recovered, jumping back into the story so fast that it was easy to miss his lapse. But now, as he spoke, he searched the audience with careful eyes. "Mishim," he said, "was not finished. The queen was pious, but the moon was crafty. I will leave it to you to decide which is the more powerful." The fourth night, as Mishim passed the queen, she tried a different ploy. "Yes," Mishim said, "your city is grand, as only a god can see from above. That is why it is so sad that one of the towers has a flawed roof." Wit swept to the side, destroying the lines of smoke that made up the city. He let the smoke dwindle, the powders he'd thrown running out, all save the line of green. "What?" Tsa said. "A flawed tower? Which one?" "It is but a minor blemish," Mishim said. "Do not let it worry you. I appreciate the effort your craftsmen, however incompetent, put into their work. She continued on her way, but knew that she had trapped the queen. Indeed, on the next night, the beautiful queen stood waiting on her balcony. "Great one of the heavens," Sa called. "We have inspected the roofs and cannot find the imperfection. Please, please tell me which tower it is, so I can break it down." "I cannot say," Mishim said. "To be mortal is to be flawed. It is not right to expect perfection of you." This only made the queen more worried. On the next night she asked, "Great one of the sky, is there a way that I could visit the heavens? I will close my ears to the stories of the Starspren and turn my eyes away from the constellations. I would look only upon the flawed works of my people, not the sights meant for you, so that I may see with my own eyes what must be fixed." "It is a forbidden thing that you ask," Mishim said, "for we would have to trade places, and hope that Noman does not notice." She said it with much glee, though hidden, for this request was the very thing she desired. "I will feign that I am you," Tsa promised, "and I will do all that you do. We will switch back once I am done, and Noman will never know." Wit grinned broadly. And so, the moon and the woman traded places. His raw enthusiasm for the story was infectious, and Shallan found herself smiling. They were at war, the city was falling, but all she wanted to do was listen to the end of this story. Wit used powders to send up 4 different smoke lines, blue, yellow, green, and intense orange. He swirled them together in a transfixing vortex of hues. And as he worked, his blue eyes fell on Shallan. They narrowed, and his smile became sly. "He just recognized me," she realized. "I'm still wearing Vale's face. But how? How did he know?" When he finished his swirling colors, the moon had become white, and the single straight tower he made by swiping up in the smoke was instead pale green. "Mishim came down among the mortals," he proclaimed, "and Sa climbed the heavens to sit in the place of the moon. Mishim spent the remaining hours of the night drinking and courting and dancing and singing and doing all the things she had watched from afar. She lived frantically during her few hours of freedom. In fact, she was so captivated that she forgot to return, and was shocked by the dawning of sunlight. She hurriedly climbed to the queen's high tower, but Sa had already set, and the night had passed. Mishim now knew not only the delights of mortality, but the anxiety as well. She passed the day in great disquiet, knowing that Sa would be trapped with her wise sister and solemn brother, spending the day in the place where moons rest. When night again came, Mishim hid inside the tower, expecting that Salus would call out and chide her for her appetites. Yet Salus passed without comment. Surely when Noman rose, he would lash out against her foolishness. Yet Noman passed without comment. Finally Tsa rose in the sky, and Mishim called to her. "Queen Tsa, mortal, what has happened? My siblings did not call to me. Did you somehow go undiscovered?" "No," Tsa replied. "Your siblings knew me as an impostor immediately." "Then let us trade places quickly," Mishim said, "so that I may tell them lies and placate them." "They are placated already," Tsa said. "They think I am delightful. We spent the daylight hours feasting." "Feasting?" Her siblings had never feasted with her before. "We sang sweet songs together." "Songs?" Her siblings had never sung with her before. "It is truly wonderful up here," Sa said. "The Starspren tell amazing tales, as you promised, and the gemstone constellations are grand from up close." "Yes, I love those stories and those sights." "I think," Tsa said,
but I might stay.
Wit let the smoke fail until only a single line of green remained. It shrank down, dwindling, almost out. When he spoke, his voice was soft.
Mishim, he said, now knew another mortal emotion. Loss. The moon began to panic. She thought of her grand view from up so high, where she could see all lands and enjoy, if from afar, their art, buildings, and songs. She remembered the kindness of Noman and the thoughtfulness of Salus. Wit made a swirl of white smoke and pushed it slowly to his left, the new moon saw close to setting.
Wait, Mishim said. Wait, saw. Your word is broken. You spoke to the Starspren and gazed upon the constellations.
Wit caught the smoke ring with one hand, somehow making it stay, swirling in one place.
Noman said that I could, Saw explained, and I was not harmed. You broke your word nonetheless, Mishim cried. You must come back to Earth, mortal, for our bargain is at an end.
Wit let the ring hang there, then vanish. To Mishim's eternal relief, Saw relented. The queen climbed back down into her tower, and Mishim scrambled up into the heavens. With great pleasure, she sank toward the horizon. Though just before she set, Mishim heard a song.
Oddly,
Wit added a small line of blue smoke to the brazier.
It was a song of laughter, of beauty, a song Mishim had never heard. It took her long to understand that song, until months later she passed in the sky at night and saw the queen in the tower again, holding a child with skin that was faintly blue. They did not speak, but Mishim knew. The queen had tricked her. Saw had wanted to spend one day in the heavens to know Noman for a night. She had given birth to a son with pale blue skin, the color of Noman himself, a son born of the gods who would lead her people to glory, a son who bore the mantle of the heavens. And that is why to this day the people of Natanatan have skin of a faintly blue shade, and it is why Mishim, though still crafty, has never again left her place. Most importantly, it is the story of how the moon came to know the one thing that before only mortals had known. Loss. The last line of blue smoke dwindled, then went out. Wit didn't bow for applause or ask for tips. He sat back down on the cistern wall that had been his stage, looking exhausted. People waited, stunned, until a few started yelling for more. Wit remained silent. He bore their requests, their pleas, then their curses. Slowly the audience drifted away. Eventually only Shallan stood before him. Wit smiled at her.
Why that story? She asked. Why now?
I don't give the meanings, child, he said. You should know that by now. I just tell the tale.
It was beautiful.
Yes, he said.
Then he added, I miss my flute.
Your what?
He hopped up and began gathering his things. Shallan slipped forward and glanced inside his pack, catching sight of a small jar, sealed at the top. It was mostly black, but the side pointed toward her was instead white. Wit snapped the pack closed.
Come. You look like you could use the opportunity to buy me something to eat.
68. Aim for the sun. My research into the cognitive reflections of Spren at the tower has been deeply illustrative. Some thought that the sibling had withdrawn from men by intent, but I find counter to that theory. From drawer 1-1. First Zircon. Wit led Shallan to a squat tavern that was so grown over with creme it gave the impression of having been molded from clay. Inside, a fabrial ceiling fan hung motionless. Starting it up would have drawn the attention of the strange, screaming Spren. Despite the large signs outside offering chowta for sale, the place was empty. The prices raised Shallan's eyebrows, but the scents emanating from the kitchen were inviting. The innkeeper was a short, heavy-set Alethi man with a paunch so thick he looked like a big chull egg. He scowled as Wit entered.
"You," he said, pointing. "Storyteller. You were supposed to draw customers here. The place would be full, you said."
"My tyrannical liege, I believe you misunderstood." Wit gave a flowery bow. "I said that you would be full, and you are. Of what, I did not say, as I did not wish to sully my tongue."
"Where are my patrons, you idiot?"
Wit stepped to the side, holding out his hands toward Shallan.
"Behold, mighty and terrible king, I have recruited you a subject."
The innkeeper squinted at her.
"Can she pay?"
"Yes," Wit said, holding up Shallan's purse and poking through it. "She'll probably leave a tip, too." With a start, Shallan felt at her pocket. Storms, she'd even kept her hand on that purse most of the day.
"Take the private room, then," the innkeeper said. "It's not like anyone else is using it. Idiot bard. I'll expect a good performance out of you tonight."
Wit sighed, tossing Shallan her purse. He seized his pack and brazier, leading her to a chamber beside the main dining room. As he ushered her in, he raised a fist toward the innkeeper.
"I've had enough of your oppression, tyrant. Secure your wine well this evening, for the revolution will be swift, vengeful, and intoxicated."
Closing the door behind him, Wit shook his head. "That man really should know better by now. I have no idea why he continues to put up with me." He set his brazier and pack by the wall, then settled at the room's dining table, where he leaned back and put his boots up on the seat next to him. Shallan sat at the table more delicately, pattern slipping off her coat and across to dimple the tabletop next to her. Wit didn't react to the Spren. The room was nice, with painted wood panels set into the walls and rock buds along a ledge near the small window. The table even had a yellow silk tablecloth. The room was obviously meant for light eyes to enjoy private dining, while unsavory dark eyes ate out in the main chamber.
"That's a nice illusion," Wit said. "You got the back of the head right. People always flub the back. You've broken character, though. You're walking like a prim light eyes, which looks silly in that costume. You'll only be able to pull off a coat and hat if you own them."
"I know," she said, grimacing. "The persona fled once you recognized me."
"Shame about the dark hair. Your natural red would be arresting with the white coat."
"This guy's is supposed to be less memorable than that." He glanced at the hat, which she'd set on the table. Shallan blushed. She felt like a girl nervously showing her first drawings to her tutor. The innkeeper entered with drinks, a mild orange, as it was still early in the day.
"Many thanks, my liege," Wit said. "I vow to compose another song about you. One without so many references to the things you've mistaken for young maidens."
"Storming idiot,"
the man said. He set the drinks on the table and didn't notice that pattern rippled out from under one. The innkeeper bustled out, closing the door.
"Are you one of them?"
Shallan blurted out.
"Are you a herald, Wit?"
Pattern hummed softly.
"Heavens, no," Wit said. "I'm not stupid enough to get mixed up in religion again. The last 7 times I tried it were all disasters. I believe there's at least one god still worshipping me by accident."
She eyed him. It was always hard to tell which of Wit's exaggerations were supposed to mean something and which were confusing distractions.
"Then what are you?"
"Some men, as they age, grow kinder. I am not one of those, for I have seen how the Cosmere can mistreat the innocent, and that leaves me disinclined toward kindness. Some men, as they age, grow wiser. I am not one of those, for wisdom and I have always been at cross purposes, and I have yet to learn the tongue in which she speaks. Some men, as they age, grow more cynical. I, fortunately, am not one of those. If I were, the very air would warp around me, sucking in all emotion, leaving only scorn." He tapped the table.
Other men, as they age, merely grow stranger. I fear that I am one of those. I am the bones of a foreign species left drying on the plain that was once long ago a sea. A curiosity, perhaps a reminder that all has not always been as it is now.
You're old, aren't you? Not a herald, but as old as they are?
He slid his boots off the chair and leaned forward, holding her eyes. He smiled in a kindly way.
Child, when they were but babes, I had already lived dozens of lifetimes. Old is a word you use for worn shoes. I'm something else entirely. She trembled, looking into those blue eyes. Shadows played within them. Shapes moved and were worn down by time. Boulders became dust. Mountains became hills. Rivers changed course. Seas became deserts.
Storms, she whispered.
When I was young, he said.
Yes,
I made a vow. Shallan nodded, wide-eyed. I said I'd always be there when I was needed.
And you have been?
Yes. She breathed out. It turns out I should have been more specific, as there is technically anywhere.
It what?
To be honest, there has so far been a random location that is of absolutely no use to anyone.
Shallan hesitated. In an instant, whatever she seemed to have sensed in Wit was gone. She flopped back in her seat.
Why am I talking to you, of all people?
Shallan, he said, aghast. If you were talking to someone else, they wouldn't be me.
I happen to know plenty of people who aren't you, Wit. I even like some of them.
Be careful. People who aren't me are prone to spontaneous bouts of sincerity.
Which is bad?
Of course. Sincerity is a word people use to justify their chronic dullness.
Well, I like sincere people, Shallan said, raising her cup. It's delightful how surprised they look when you push them down the stairs.
Now that's unkind. You shouldn't push people down the stairs for being sincere. You push people down the stairs for being stupid.
What if they're sincere and stupid?
Then you run.
I quite like arguing with them instead. They do make me look smart, and Vev knows I need the help.
No, no, you should never debate an idiot, Shallan. No more than you'd use your best sword to spread butter.
Oh, but I'm a scholar. I enjoy things with curious properties, and stupidity is most interesting. The more you study it, the further it flees, and yet the more of it you obtain, the less you understand about it.
Wit sipped his drink. True, to an extent. But it can be hard to spot, as, like body odor, you never notice your own. That said, put two smart people together, and they will eventually find their common stupidity and in so doing become idiots.
Like a child, it grows the more you feed it.
Like a fashionable dress, it can be fetching in youth, but looks particularly bad on the aged. And unique though its properties may be, stupidity is frighteningly common. The sum total of stupid people is somewhere around the population of the planet.
Plus one.
Plus one? Shallan asked.
Sadius counts twice.
He's dead, Wit.
What?
Wit sat up straight.
Someone murdered him
We don't know who.
Aladar's investigators had continued hunting the culprit, but the investigation had stalled by the time Shallan left.
Someone offed old Sadeus, and I missed it?
What would you have done? Helped him?
Storms, no. I'd have applauded.
Shallan grinned and let out a deep sigh. Her hair had reverted to red. She'd let the illusion lapse.
Wit, she said. Why are you here? In the city?
I'm not completely sure.
Please, could you just answer?
I did, and I was honest.
I can know where I'm supposed to be, Shallan, but not always what I'm supposed to do there.
He tapped the table.
Why are you here?
To open the Oath Gate, Shallan said. Save the city.
Pattern hummed.
Lofty goals, Wit said.
What's the point of goals if not to spur you to something lofty?
Yes, yes. Aim for the sun. That way, if you miss, at least your arrow will fall far away, and the person it kills will likely be someone you don't know.
The innkeeper chose that moment to arrive with some food. Shallan didn't feel particularly hungry. Seeing all those starving people outside had stolen her appetite. The small plates held crumbly cakes of soul-cast grain topped with a single steamed kremling, a variety known as a scrip, with a flat tail, two large claws, and long antennae. Eating kremlings wasn't uncommon, but it wasn't particularly fine dining. The only difference between Shallan's meal and Wit's was the sauce, hers sweet, his spicy, though his had the sauce in a cup at the side. Food supplies were tight, and the kitchen wasn't preparing both masculine and feminine dishes. The innkeeper frowned at her hair, then shook his head and left. She got the impression he was accustomed to oddities around Wit. Shallan looked down at her food. Could she give this to someone else? Someone who deserved it more than she did?
Eat up, Wit said, rising and walking to the small window. Don't waste what you're given.
Reluctantly, she did as he instructed.
It wasn't particularly good, but it wasn't terrible. Aren't you going to eat? She asked.
I'm smart enough not to follow my own advice, thank you very much.
He sounded distracted. Outside the window, a procession from the Cult of Moments was passing.
I want to learn to be like you, Shallan said, feeling silly as she said it.
No, you don't. You're funny and charming and... Yes, yes, I'm so storming clever that half the time even I can't follow what I'm talking about.
And you change things, Wit. When you came to me in Yakeved, you changed everything. I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to change the world.
He didn't seem at all interested in his food. Does he eat? She wondered. Or is he like some kind of spren?
Who came with you to the city? He asked her.
Kaladin, Adolin, Elokar, some of our servants.
King Elokar here?
He's determined to save the city.
Most days, Elokar has trouble saving face, let alone cities.
I like him, Shallan said, despite his Elokar-ness.
He does grow on you, I suppose, like a fungus.
He really wants to do what is right. You should hear him talk about it lately. He wants to be remembered as a good king.
Vanity.
You don't care about how you'll be remembered?
I'll remember myself, which is enough. Elokar, though, he worries about the wrong things. His father wore a simple crown because he needed no reminder of his authority. Elokar wears a simple crown because he worries that something more lavish might make people look at it instead of at him. He doesn't want the competition.
Wit turned away from his inspection of the hearth and chimney.
You want to change the world, Shallan. That's well and good, but be careful. The world predates you. She has seniority.
I'm radiant, Shallan said,
shoving another forkful of crumbly sweet bread into her mouth. "Saving the world is in the job description.
Then be wise about it.
There are two kinds of important men, Shallan. There are those who, when the boulder of time rolls toward them, stand up in front of it and hold out their hands. All their lives they've been told how great they are. They assume the world itself will bend to their whims as their nurse did when fetching them a fresh cup of milk. Those men end up squished. Other men stand to the side when the boulder of time passes, but are quick to say, 'See what I did? I made the boulder roll there. Don't make me do it again.' These men end up getting everyone else squished."
"Is there not a third type of person?"
"There is, but they are oh so rare. These know they can't stop the boulder, so they walk beside it, study it, and bide their time. Then they shove it, ever so slightly, to create a deviation in its path. These are the men... Well, these are the men who actually change the world. And they terrify me, for men never see as far as they think they do." Shallan frowned, then looked at her empty plate. She hadn't thought she was hungry, but once she'd started eating... Wit walked past and deftly lifted her plate away, then swapped it with his full one.
"Wit, I can't eat that."
"Don't be persnickety," he said. "How are you going to save the world if you starve yourself?"
"I'm not starving myself," but she took a little bite to satisfy him. "You make it sound like having the power to change the world is a bad thing."
"Bad? No. Abhorrent, depressing, ghastly. Having power is a terrible burden, the worst thing imaginable, except for every other alternative."
He turned and studied her.
"What is power to you, Shallan?"
"It's..." Shallan cut at the kremling, separating it from its shell. "It's what I said earlier. The ability to change things."
"Things?"
"Other people's lives. Power is the ability to make life better or worse for the people around you."
"And yourself, too, of course."
"I don't matter."
"You should."
"Selflessness is a Vorin virtue, Wit."
"Oh, bother that! You've got to live life, Shallan. Enjoy life. Drink of what you're proposing to give everyone else. That's what I do."
"You do seem to enjoy yourself a great deal."
"I like to live every day like it's my last," Shallan nodded. "And by that I mean lying in a puddle of my own urine, calling for the nurse to bring me more pudding."
She almost choked on a bite of kremling. Her cup was empty, but Wit walked past and put his in her hand. She gulped it down.
"Power is a knife," Wit said, taking his seat. "A terrible, dangerous knife that can't be wielded without cutting yourself. We joked about stupidity, but in reality most people aren't stupid. Many are simply frustrated at how little control they have over their lives. They lash out, sometimes in spectacular ways.
The cult of moments. They reportedly claim to see a transformed world coming upon us."
"Be wary of anyone who claims to be able to see the future, Shallan."
"Except you, of course. Didn't you say you can see where you need to be?"
"Be wary," he repeated, "of anyone who claims to be able to see the future, Shallan."
Pattern rippled on the table, not humming, only changing more quickly, forming new shapes in a rapid sequence. Shallan swallowed. To her surprise, her plate was empty again. "The cult has control of the Oathgate platform," she said. "Do you know what they do up there every night?"
"They feast," Wit said softly. "And party. There are two general divisions among them. The common members wander the streets, moaning, pretending to be Spren. But others up on the platform actually know the Spren, specifically the creature known as the Heart of the Revel."
"One of the Unmade," Wit nodded.
"A dangerous foe, Shallan.
The cult reminds me of a group I knew long ago, equally dangerous, equally foolish.
Elokar wants me to infiltrate them. Get onto that platform and activate the Oath Gate. Is it possible?
Perhaps.
Wit settled back.
Perhaps. I can't make the gate work. The spren of the Fabriel won't obey me. You have the proper key, and the cult takes new members eagerly. Consumes them. Like a fire needing new logs.
How? What do I do?
Food, he said. Their proximity to the heart drives them to feast and celebrate.
Drinking in life, she said, quoting his sentiment from earlier.
No. Hedonism has never been enjoyment, Shallan, but the opposite. They take the wonderful things of life and indulge until they lose savor. It's listening to beautiful music performed so loud as to eliminate all subtlety, taking something beautiful and making it carnal. Yet their feasting does give you an opening. I've brushed against their leaders, despite my best efforts. Bring them food for the revel, and I can get you in. A warning, however. Simple soul-cast grain won't satisfy them.
A challenge, then. I should get back to the others. She looked up to Wit. Would you come with me? Join us?
He stood, then walked to the door and pressed his ear against it. Unfortunately, Shallan, he said, glancing at her, you're not why I am here.
She took a deep breath.
I am going to learn how to change the world, Wit. You already know how. Learn why.
He stepped back from the door and pressed himself against the wall.
Also, tell the innkeeper I disappeared in a puff of smoke. It will drive him crazy.
The door opened suddenly, swinging inward. The innkeeper entered and hesitated as he found Shallan sitting alone at the table.
Wit slipped deftly around the door and out behind the man, who didn't notice.
Damnation, the innkeeper said, searching around. I don't suppose he's going to work tonight.
I have no idea.
He said he'd treat me like a king.
Well, he's keeping that promise.
The innkeeper took the plates, then bustled out.
Conversations with Wit had a way of ending in an odd manner, and, well, starting in an odd manner. Odd all around.
Do you know anything about Wit? She asked Pattern.
No, Pattern said. He feels like, one of us.
Shallan fished in her pouch for some spheres. Wit had stolen a few, she noted, as a tip for the poor innkeeper. Then she made her way back to the tailor's shop, planning how to use her team to get the requisite food.
69. Free meal, no strings. The wilting of plants and the general cooling of the air is disagreeable, yes, but some of the tower's functions remain in place. The increased pressure, for example, persists. From drawer 1-1, second zircon. Kaladin drew in a small amount of stormlight and stoked the tempest within. That little storm raged inside him, raising from his skin, haunting the space behind his eyes and making them glow. Fortunately, though he stood in a busy market square, this tiny amount of stormlight wouldn't be enough for people to see in the bright sunlight. The storm was a primal dance, an ancient song, an eternal battle that had raged since Roshar was new. It wanted to be used. He acquiesced, kneeling to infuse a small stone. He lashed it upward just enough to make it tremble, but not enough to send it zipping into the air. The eerie screams came soon after. People started to shout in panic. Kaladin ducked away, exhaling his stormlight and becoming, hopefully, merely another bystander. He crouched with Shallan and Adolin behind a planter. This plaza, with pillared archways on all four sides, sheltering what had once been a great variety of shops, was several blocks away from the tailor's shop. People squeezed into buildings or slipped out onto other streets. The slow ones simply huddled down beside the walls, hands over their heads. The Spren arrived as two lines of bright yellow-white, twisting about one another above the plaza. Their inhuman screeches were awful. Like the sound of a wounded animal dying alone in the wilderness. Those weren't the Spren he'd seen while traveling with Saw and the other Parshmen. That one had seemed more akin to a wind Spren. These looked like vivid yellow spheres crackling with energy. They didn't seem to be able to pinpoint the rock directly, and spun over the courtyard as if confused, still screaming. A short time later, a figure descended from the sky, a Voidbringer in loose red and black clothing that rippled and churned in the breeze. He carried a spear and a tall, triangular shield. That spear, Kaladin thought, long with a slender point for puncturing armor. It was like a horseman's lance. He found himself nodding. That would be an excellent weapon for using in flight, where you'd need extra reach to attack men on the ground, or even enemies soaring around you. The Spren ceased screaming. The Voidbringer looked about, fluttering through the air, then glared at the Spren and said something. Again they seemed confused. They'd sensed Kaladin's use of stormlight, likely interpreted it as a fabrial being used, but now couldn't pinpoint the location. Kaladin had used such a small amount of stormlight the rock had lost its charge almost immediately. The Spren dispersed, vanishing as emotion Spren often did. The Voidbringer lingered, surrounded by dark energy, until horns nearby announced the wall guard approaching. The creature finally shot back into the air. People who had been hiding scuttled away, looking relieved to have escaped with their lives.
"Huh,"
Adolin said, standing. He wore an illusion imitating, as per Elikar's instructions, Captain Lord Melloran Kahl, Teshev's youngest son, a powerfully built balding man in his 30s.
"I can hold stormlight as long as I want without drawing attention," Kaladin said. "The moment I lash something, they come screaming."
"And yet," Adolin said, glancing at Shallan, "the disguises draw no attention."
"Patton says we're quieter than him," Shallan said, thumbing toward Kaladin. "Come on, let's get back. Don't you boys have an appointment tonight?"
"A party," Kaladin said, pacing back and forth in the tailor shop's showroom. Scar and Drahi leaned by the doorway, each with a spear in the crook of his arm. "This is what they're like," Kaladin said. "Your city is practically burning. What should you do? Throw a party, obviously." Elikar had suggested parties as a way of contacting the city's light-eyed families. Kaladin had laughed at the idea, assuming that there wouldn't be such a thing. Yet with minimal searching, Adolin had scrounged up half a dozen invitations. "Good dark-eyed people slave away, growing and preparing food," Kaladin said. "But the light-eyes? They have so much storming time they have to make up things to do." "Hey, Scar," Drey said. "You ever go out drinking, even when at war?" "Sure," Scar said. "And back in my village, we'd have a dance in the storm shelter twice a month, even while boys were off fighting in border skirmishes." "It's not the same," Kaladin said. "You taking their side?"
"Are there sides?" Drahi asked.
A few minutes later, Adolin came tromping down the stairs and grinning like a fool. He was wearing a ruffled shirt under a powder blue suit with a jacket that didn't close all the way and tails at the back. Its golden embroidery was the finest the shop could provide.
"Please tell me," Kaladin said, "that you didn't bring us to live with your tailor because you wanted a new wardrobe."
"Come on, Cal," Adolin said, inspecting himself in a showroom mirror. "I need to look the part."
He checked his cuffs and grinned again. Yokska came out and looked him over, then dusted his shoulders.
"I think it pulls too tightly through the chest, right, Lord?"
"It's wonderful, Yokska."
Take a deep breath. It was like she was a storming surgeon, the way she lifted his arm and felt at his waist, muttering to herself. Kaladin had seen his father give physicals that were less invasive.
I thought that straight coats were still the style, Adolin said. I have a folio out of Leofor.
Those aren't up to date, Yokska said. I was in Leofor last mid-peace, and they're moving away from military styles. But they made those folios to sell uniforms at the Shattered Plains.
Storms! I had no idea how unfashionable I was being.
Kaladin rolled his eyes. Adolin saw that in the mirror, but just turned around, giving a bow.
Don't worry, bridge boy, you can continue to wear clothing to match your scowl.
You look like you tripped and fell into a bucket of blue paint, Kaladin said, then tried to dry off with a handful of parched grass.
And you look like what the storm leaves behind, Adolin said, passing by and patting Kaladin on the shoulder. We like you anyway. Every boy has a favorite stick he found out in the yard after the rains.
Adolin stepped over to Scar and Drahi, clasping hands with each of them in turn.
You two looking forward to tonight?
Depends on how the food is in the dark-eyed tent, sir, Scar said.
Swipe me something from the inner party, Drahi said. I hear they've got storming good pastries at those fancy light eyes parties.
Sure. You need anything, Scar?
The head of my enemy fashioned into a tankard for drinking, Scar said. Barring that, I'll take a pastry or seven.
I'll see what I can do. Keep your ears open for any good taverns that are still open. We can go out tomorrow.
He strode past Kaladin and tied on a side sword. Kaladin frowned, looking to him, then to his bridgeman, then back at Adolin.
What?
What? Adolin asked.
You're going to go out drinking with bridgemen?
Kaladin said.
Sure, Adolin said. Scar Drahi and I go way back.
We spent some time keeping His Highness from falling into chasms, Scar said. He repaid us with a bit of wine and good conversation.
The king entered, wearing a more muted version of the same style of uniform. He bustled past Adolin, heading toward the stairs.
Ready? Excellent. Time for new faces.
The three stopped by Shallan's room, where she was sketching and humming to herself, surrounded by creation spren. She gave Adolin a kiss that was more intimate than Kaladin had seen from the two of them before, then changed him back into Melaran Kal. Elikar became an older man, also bald, with pale yellow eyes. General Kal, one of Dalinar's highest officers.
I'm fine, Kaladin said as she eyed him. Nobody is going to recognize me.
He wasn't sure what it was, but wearing another face like that, to him, it felt like lying.
The scars, Elikar said. We need you not to stand out, Captain.
Reluctantly, Kaladin nodded and allowed Shallan to add a light weaving to his head to make the slave brands vanish. Then she handed each of them a sphere. The illusions were tied to the stormlight inside of those. If the sphere ran out, their false faces would vanish. The group set out, Scar and Drahi joining them, spears at the ready. Syl flitted out from an upper window of the shop, soaring on ahead of them along the street. Kaladin had tested summoning her as a blade earlier, and that hadn't drawn the screamers, so he felt well armed. Adolin immediately started joking with Scar and Drahi. Dalinar wouldn't have liked to hear they'd gone out drinking. Not because of any specific prejudice, but there was a command structure to an army. Generals weren't supposed to fraternize with the rank and file. It threw wrinkles into how armies worked. Adolin could get away with things like that. As he listened, Kaladin found himself feeling ashamed of his earlier attitude. The truth was, he was feeling pretty good these days. Yes, there was a war, and yes, the city was seriously stressed, but ever since he'd found his parents alive and well, he'd been feeling better. That wasn't so uncommon a feeling for him. He felt good lots of days. Trouble was, on the bad days, that was hard to remember. At those times, for some reason, he felt like he had always been in darkness, and always would be. Why was it so hard to remember? Did he have to keep slipping back down? Why couldn't he stay up here in the sunlight where everyone else lived? It was nearing evening, maybe 2 hours from sunset. They passed several plazas, like the one where they'd tested his surge binding. Most had been turned into living space, with people crowding in, just sitting and waiting for whatever would happen next. Kaladin trailed a little behind the others, and when Adolin noticed, he excused himself from the conversation and dropped back.
"Hey," he said. "You all right?"
"I'm worried that summoning a shardblade would make me stand out too much," Kaladin said. "I should have brought a spear tonight."
"Maybe you should let me teach you how to use a side sword. You're pretending to be head of our bodyguards tonight, and you're light-eyed today. It looks strange for you to walk around without a side sword."
"Maybe I'm one of those punchy guys." Adolin stopped in place and grinned at Kaladin.
"Did you just say punchy guys?"
"You know, ardents who train to fight unarmed."
"Hand to hand?"
"Hand to hand."
"Right," Adolin said. "Or punchy guys, as everyone calls them."
Kaladin met his eyes, then found himself grinning back.
"It's the academic term."
"Sure. Like swordy fellows, or spearish chaps."
"I once knew a real axolaceous bloke," Kaladin said. "He was great at psychological fights."
"Psychological fights?"
"He could really get inside someone's head." Adolin frowned as they walked.
"Get inside... oh!"
Adolin chuckled, slapping Kaladin on the back.
"You talk like a girl sometimes. I mean that as a compliment."
"Thanks."
"But you do need to practice the sword more," Adolin said, growing excited. "I know you like the spear and you're good with it. Great. But you're not simply a spearman anymore. You're going to be an irregular. You won't be fighting in a line holding a shield for your buddies. Who knows what you'll be facing?"
"I trained a little with Zahel," Kaladin said. "I'm not completely useless with a sword, but part of me doesn't see the point."
"You'll be better if you practice with a sword, trust me. Being a good duelist is about knowing one weapon, and being a good foot soldier, that's probably more about training than it is about any single weapon. But you want to be a great warrior? For that, you need to be able to use the best tool for the job. Even if you're never going to use a sword, you'll fight people who do. The best way to learn how to defeat someone wielding a weapon is to practice with it yourself."
Kaladin nodded. He was right. It was strange to look at Adolin in that bright outfit, stylish and glittering with golden thread, and hear him speak real battle sense. "When I was imprisoned for daring to accuse Amaram, he was the only Light Eyes who stood up for me." Adolin Kolin was simply a good person, powder blue clothing and all. You couldn't hate a man like him. Storms, you kind of had to like him. Their destination was a modest home by Light Eyed standard. Tall and narrow, at 4 stories high, it could have housed a dozen Dark Eyed families.
"All right," Elokar said as they drew near. "Adolin and I will feel out the Light Eyes for potential allies. Bridgman, chat with those in the Dark-Eyed Guard tent and see if you can discover anything about the Cult of Moments or other oddities in the city."
"Got it, Your Majesty," Dreyu said.
"Captain," he said to Kaladin, "you'll go to the Light-Eyed Guard tent. See if you can
find out anything about this High Marshal Azure person," Kaladin said. "From the Wall Guard."
"Yes. We will plan to stay relatively late, as intoxicated party guests might share more than sober ones."
They broke, Adolin and Elokar presenting invitations to the doorman, who let them in, then gestured Drahi and Scar toward the Dark-Eyed Guard's feast, happening in a tent set up on the grounds. There was a separate tent for people who were light-eyed but not landowners. Privileged, but not good enough to get in the doors to the actual party. In his role as a light-eyed bodyguard, that would be the place for Kaladin. But for some reason, the thought of going in there made him feel sick.
Instead, he whispered to Scar and Drahi, promising to be back soon, and borrowed Scar's spear just in case. Then Kaladin left, walking the block. He'd return to do as told by Elokar, but while there was enough light, he thought he'd maybe survey the wall and see if he could get an idea of the wall guard's numbers. More, he wanted to walk a little longer. He strolled to the foot of the nearby city wall, counting guard posts on top, looking at the large lower portion that was a natural part of the local rock. He rested his hand on the smooth, strata-lined formation of stone.
"Hey!" a voice called. "Hey, you!"
Kaladin sighed. A squad of soldiers from the wall guard was patrolling here. They considered this road around the city, next to the foot of the wall, to be their jurisdiction, but they didn't patrol any farther inward. What did they want? He wasn't doing anything wrong. Well, running would only stir up a ruckus, so he dropped his spear and turned around, extending his arms out to the sides. In a city full of refugees, certainly they wouldn't harass one man too much. A squad of five tromped over to him, led by a man with a wispy dark beard and bright, light blue eyes. The man took in Kaladin's uniform, with no insignia, and glanced at the fallen spear. Then he looked at Kaladin's forehead and frowned. Kaladin raised his hands to the brands there, which he could feel. But Shallan had put an illusion over those, hadn't she? Damnation. He's going to assume I'm a deserter.
Deserter, I assume?
The soldier asked sharply. Should have just gone to the storming party. Look, Kaladin said. I don't want trouble, I just...
Do you want a meal?
A meal?
Free food for deserters.
That's unexpected. Reluctantly, he lifted the hair from his forehead, testing to see that the brands were still visible. Mostly, the hair prevented one from seeing the details. The soldiers started visibly. Yes, they could see the brands. Shallan's illusion had worn off for some reason. Hopefully the other disguises fared better.
A light as with a shash brand? Their lieutenant asked. Storm's friend. You've got to have some story.
He slapped Kaladin on the back and pointed toward their barracks ahead.
I'd love to hear it. Free meal. No strings. We won't press you into service. I give my oath.
Well, he'd wanted information about the leader of the wall guard, hadn't he? What better place to get it than from these men? Kaladin picked up his spear and let them lead him away. 70. High Marshal Azure. Something is happening to the sibling. I agree this is true, but the division among the Knights Radiant is not to blame. Our perceived worthiness is a separate issue. From Drawer 1-1, 3rd Zircon. The Wall Guard's barracks smelled like home to Kaladin. Not his father's house, which smelled of antiseptic and the flowers his mother crushed to season the air. His true home. Leather, boiling stew, crowded men, weapon oil. Spears hung on the walls, white and blue. The place was big enough to house two platoons, a fact confirmed by the shoulder patches he saw. The large common room was filled with tables, and a few armorers worked in the corner sewing jerkins or uniforms. Others sharpened weapons, a rhythmic calming sound. These were the noises and scents of an army well maintained. The stew didn't smell anywhere near as good as rocks. Kaladin had been spoiled by the Horn Eater's cooking. Still, when one of the men went to fetch him a bowl, he found himself smiling. He settled onto a long wooden bench near a fidgety little ardent who was scribing glyph words onto pieces of cloth for the men. Kaladin instantly loved this place, and the state of the men spoke highly of High Marshal Azure. He would likely be some middling officer who had been thrust into command during the chaos of the riots, which made him all the more impressive. Azure had secured the wall, gotten the parchment out of the city, and seen to the defense of Kolinar. Syl zipped around the rafters as soldiers called out questions about the newcomer. The lieutenant who had found him, his name was Noromin, but his men called him Noro, answered readily. Kaladin was a deserter. He had a shash brand, an ugly one. You should see it. Satius's mark. On a light eyes, no less. The others in the barrack found this curious, but not worrisome. Some even cheered. Storms. Kaladin couldn't imagine any force of Dalinar's soldiers being so welcoming of a deserter, let alone a dangerous one. Considering that, Kaladin now picked out another undercurrent in the room. Men sharpening weapons that had chips in them. Armorers repairing cuts in leather. Cuts made by lances in battle. Conspicuously empty seats at most of the tables, with cups set at them. These men had suffered losses. Not huge ones yet. They could still laugh. But storms, there was a tension to this room. "So," Noro said. "Shash brand?" The rest of the squad settled in, and a short man with hair on the backs of his hands set a bowl of thick stew and flatbread in front of Kaladin. Standard fare with steamed talu and cubed meat. Soulcast, of course, and lacking flavor, but hearty and nutritious. "I had a squabble," Kaladin said, "with High Lord Amaram. I felt he'd gotten some of my men killed needlessly. He disagreed."
"Amaram," said one of the men. "You aim high, friend." "I know Amaram," the man with hairy hands said. "I did secret missions for him, back in my operative days."
Kaladin looked at him, surprised.
"Best to ignore Beard," Lieutenant Noro said. "It's what the rest of us do."
Beard didn't have a beard. Maybe the hairy hands were enough. He nudged Kaladin.
"It's a good story. I'll tell it to you sometime." "You can't just brand a light-eyed man a slave," Lieutenant Noro said. "You need a High Prince's permission. There's more to this story."
"There is," Kaladin said. Then he continued eating his stew.
"Ooh," said a tall member of the squad. "Mystery."
Noro chuckled, then waved at the room.
"So, what do you think?"
"You said you weren't going to press me," Kaladin said between bites.
"I'm not pressing you, but you won't find a place out there in the city where you'll eat as well as you do here."
"Where do you get it?" Kaladin asked, spooning the stew into his mouth. "You can't use soulcasters. The screamers will come after you. Stockpile? I'm surprised one of the High Lords in the city hasn't tried to appropriate it."
"Astute," Lieutenant Noro said with a smile. He had a disarming way about him. "That's a guard secret. But in here there's always a stew bubbling and bread baking." "It's my recipe," Beard added.
"Oh, please," the tall man said. "You're a cook now too, Beard?"
"A chef, thank you very much. I learned that flatbread recipe from a horn-eater mystic at the top of a mountain. The real story is how I got there."
"It's where you landed, obviously," the tall soldier said, "after someone in your last squad kicked you."
The men laughed. It felt warm in here, on this long bench, a well-laid fire burning steadily in the corner. Warm and friendly. As Kaladin ate, they gave him some space, chatting among themselves. Noro, he seemed less a soldier and more a chummy merchant trying to sell you earrings for your beloved. He dropped very obvious, dangling hints for Kaladin. Reminders of how well-fed they were, of how good it was to be part of a squad. He spoke of warm beds, of how they didn't have to go on watch duty that often, of playing cards while the high storm blew. Kaladin got a second bowl of stew, and as he settled back into his place, he realized something with a shock. Storms. They're all light eyes, aren't they? Every person in the room, from the cook to the armorers to the soldiers doing dishes. In a group like this, everyone had a secondary duty, like armoring or field surgery. Kaladin hadn't noticed their eyes. The place had felt so natural, so comfortable, that he'd assumed they were all dark-eyed, like him. He knew that most light-eyed soldiers weren't high officers. He'd been told that they were basically just people. He'd been told it over and over. Somehow, sitting in that room finally made the fact real to him.
So, Cal? Lieutenant Noro asked. What do you think? Maybe, re-enlist? Give this another try?
Aren't you afraid I'll desert? Kaladin asked. Or worse, that I can't control my temper? I might be dangerous?
Not as dangerous as being short-manned, Beard said. You know how to kill people? That's good enough for us.
Kaladin nodded.
Tell me about your commander. That will be a big part of any group. I only just got into town. Who is this High Marshal Azure?
You can meet him yourself, Beard said. He does rounds every night around dinner time, checking on each barracks.
Yes, Noro said.
Kaladin eyed him. The lieutenant seemed uncomfortable.
The High Marshal, Noro said quickly, is incredible. We lost our former commander during the riots, and Azure led a group who held the wall when the Cult of Moments tried, in the chaos, to seize the city gates.
He fought like a Voidbringer, another squad member said. I was there. We were almost overwhelmed, then Azure joined us, holding aloft a gleaming shard blade. He rallied our numbers, inspired even the wounded to keep fighting. Storms felt like we had Spren at our backs, holding us up, helping us fight.
Kaladin narrowed his eyes.
You don't say.
He pried more from them as he finished his bowl. They had nothing but praise for Azure, though the man hadn't displayed any other odd abilities that Kaladin could discover. Azure was a shard-bearer, maybe a foreigner, who had been previously unknown to the guard. But with the fall of their commander and the subsequent disappearance of their High Lord patron at the palace, Azure had ended up in command. There was something else, something they weren't saying. Kaladin helped himself to a third bowl of stew, more to delay to see if the High Marshal really would make an appearance or not. Soon, a disturbance near the door sent men standing up. Kaladin followed suit, turning. A senior officer entered, wearing a glittering chain and a bright tabard, accompanied by attendants, inspiring a round of salutes. The High Marshal wore an appropriately azure cloak, a lighter shade than the traditional Colin blue, with a mail coif down around the neck, and a helm carried in hand. He was also a she. Kaladin blinked in surprise and heard a gasp from Syl up above. The High Marshal was of average height for an Alethi woman, maybe just under, and wore her hair straight and short, reaching halfway down her cheeks. Her eyes were orange, and she wore a side sword with a glistening silver basket hilt. That wasn't Alethi design. Was it the aforementioned shard blade? It did have an otherworldly look about it, but why wear it instead of dismissing it? Regardless, the High Marshal was lean and grim and had a couple of serious scars on her face. She wore gloves on both hands.
"The High Marshal is a woman?" Kaladin hissed. "We don't talk about the Marshal's secret," Beard said.
"Secret?" Kaladin said. "It's pretty storming obvious."
"We don't talk about the Marshal's secret," Beard repeated, and the others nodded. "Hush, all right?"
Hush about it? Storms, this sort of thing simply didn't happen in Boren society. Not like in the ballads and stories. He'd been in three armies, and had never seen a woman holding a weapon. Even the Alethi scouts carried only knives. He'd half expected a riot when he'd armed Lin and the others, although for Radiance, Yasna and Shallan had already supplied precedent. Azure told the men they could sit down. One of the men offered her a bowl of stew, and she accepted. The men cheered after she took a bite and complimented the cook. She handed the bowl to one of her attendants, and things returned to normal. Men chatting, working, eating. Azure walked to speak with the various officers. First the platoon leader, who would be a captain. The other lieutenants next. When she stopped at their table, she took in Kaladin with a discerning gaze.
"Who is the new recruit, Lieutenant Noro?" she asked.
"This is Cal, sir," Noro said. "Found him haunting the street outside. Deserter with a shash brand."
"On a light eyes. Storms, man, who did you kill?"
It's not the one that I killed that got me my brand, sir. It's the one I didn't kill. That has the sound of a practiced explanation, soldier. That's because it is. Kaladin figured she, at last, would push for more information. She merely grunted. He couldn't place her age, though the scars probably made her look older than she really was. "You joining up?" she said. "We have food for you." "Frankly, sir, I don't know. On one hand, I can't believe nobody cares about my past. On the other, you're obviously desperate, which also makes me reluctant." She turned toward Lieutenant Noro. "You haven't shown him?"
"No, sir. We just got some stew in him."
"I'll do it. Cal, come with me."
Whatever they wanted to show him was at the top of the wall as they hiked him up an enclosed stone stairwell. Kaladin wanted to learn more about the supposed secret that Azure was a woman. But when he asked, Lieutenant Noro shook his head quickly and made a hushing motion. Soon they'd assembled atop the fortifications. The Kolinar Wall was a powerful defensive structure, reportedly over 60 feet tall at points, with a wide wall walk on the top, 10 feet across. The wall rolled across the landscape, enclosing all of Kolinar. It had actually been built on top of the outer wind blades, fitting onto them like an inverted crown, the raised portions matching crevasses between wind blades. The wall was interrupted by guard towers every 300 feet or so. These large structures were big enough to house squads, perhaps entire platoons, on watch.
"Guessing from that brand," Azure said to him, "you were in one of the armies that recruits in the north. You joined up to fight on the Shattered Plains, didn't you? But Sadeus used that army up north to funnel in veterans, plus maybe seize some land now and then from rival high princes. You ended up fighting other Alethi, scared farm boys, instead of shipping off to avenge the king. Something like that?"
"Something like that," Kaladin admitted.
"Damnation me if I blame a man for deserting that," Azure said. "I don't hold it against you, soldier."
"And the brand?" Azure pointed northward. Night had finally fallen, and in the distance, Kaladin could see a glow.
"They advance back into place after each storm," Azure said softly, "and camp a portion of their army out there. That's good battle sense to prevent us from being resupplied, and to make sure we don't know when they'll attack. Nightmares, Cal. A real void-bringer army. If that were an Alethi force, the people in the city wouldn't have much to worry about. Sure, there would be casualties on the wall, but no would-be king of Alethkar is going to burn and pillage the capital. But those aren't Alethi. They're monsters. At best, they'll enslave the entire populace. At worst..." She let the thought dangle, then looked at him. "I'm glad you have a brand. It says you're dangerous, and we have narrow confines up here on the wall. We can't simply press every eligible man. I need real soldiers, men who know what they're doing."
"So that's why I'm here?" Kaladin asked. "To see that?"
"I want you to think," Azure said. "I tell the men, this wall guard, this is redemption. If you fight here, nobody will care what you did before, because they know if we fall, this city and this nation will be no more. Nothing matters except holding this wall when that assault comes. You can go hide in the city and pray that we are strong enough without you. But if we aren't, you'll be no more than another corpse. Up here, you can fight. Up here, you have a chance. We won't press you. Walk away tonight. Lie down and think about what is coming. Imagine another night when men are up here dying, bleeding for you. Think about how powerless you'll feel if the monsters get in. Then when you come back tomorrow, we'll get you a wall guard patch."
It was a potent speech, Kaladin glanced to Syl, who landed on his shoulder, then took a long look at the lights on the horizon.
Are you out there, Saw? Did they bring you and the others here?
What of Saw's little daughter, who had collected flowers and clutched playing cards like a treasured toy? Was Khen there, the Parsh woman who had demanded Kaladin retain his freedom despite being angry at him for the entire trip? Winds send that they hadn't been dragged further into this mess. He joined the others in clattering back down the stairwell. Afterward, Noro and the rest of the squad bade him a happy farewell as if certain he'd return. And he probably would, though not for the reasons they assumed. He went back to the mansion and forced himself to chat with some of the guards at the light-eyed tent, though he learned nothing, and his brands made something of a stir among them. Adolin and Elokar finally emerged, their illusions intact. So what was wrong with Kaladin's? The sphere Shallan had given him was still infused. Kaladin gathered Drahi and Scar, then joined the king and Adolin as they started the walk home.
"What has you so thoughtful, Captain?" Elokar asked.
"I think," Kaladin said, eyes narrowed, "I might have found us another Radiant." 71. A Sign of Humanity. 11 years ago. There weren't enough boats for an amphibious attack on Rathalas, so Dalinar was forced to use a more conventional assault. He marched down from the west, having sent Adolin back to Kolinar, and assigned Satius and his forces to come in from the east. They converged toward the rift. Dalinar spent much of the trip passing through pungent smoke trails from the incense Evie burned in a small censer attached to the side of her carriage. A petition to the heralds to bless her marriage. He often heard her weeping inside the vehicle, though whenever she left it she was perfectly composed. She read letters, scribed his responses, and took notes at his meetings with generals. In every way she was the perfect Alethi wife. But her unhappiness crushed his soul. Eventually they reached the plains around the lake, crossing the riverbed, which was dry except during storms. The rock buds drank so fully of the local water supply they'd grown to enormous sizes. Some were taller than a man's waist, and the vines they produced were as thick as Dalinar's wrist. He rode alongside the carriage, his horse's hooves beating a familiar rhythm on the stones beneath, and smelled incense. Evie's hand reached out of her carriage's side window, and she placed another glyph ward into the censer. He didn't see her face, and her hand retreated quickly. Storming woman. An Alethi would be using this as a ploy to guilt him into bending. But she wasn't Alethi, for all her earnest imitations. Evie was far too genuine, and her tears were real. She sincerely thought their spat back in the Vaden Fortress boded ill for their relationship. That bothered him, more than he wanted to admit. A young scout jogged up to give him the latest report. The vanguard had secured his desired campground near the city. There had been no fighting yet, and he hadn't expected any. Tanalan would not abandon the walls around the rift to try to control ground beyond Bowshot. It was good news, but Dalinar still wanted to snap at the messenger. He wanted to snap at someone. Stormfather, this battle couldn't come soon enough. He restrained himself and sent the messenger woman away with a word of thanks. Why did he care so much about Evie's petulance? He'd never let his arguments with Gavilar bother him. Storms, he'd never let his arguments with Evie bother him this way before. It was strange. He could have the accolades of men, fame that stretched across a continent. But if she didn't admire him, he felt that he had somehow failed. Could he really ride into combat feeling like this? No, he couldn't. Then do something about it. As they wound through the plain of rock buds, he called to the driver of Evie's carriage, having him stop. Then, handing his horse's reins to an attendant, he climbed into the carriage. Evie bit her lip as he settled down on the seat across from her. It smelled nice within. The incense was fainter here, while the creme dust of the road was blocked by wooden cloth. The cushions were plush, and she had some dried fruit in a dish, even some chilled water.
"What is wrong?" she demanded.
"I was feeling saddle sore."
She cocked her head.
"Perhaps you could request a salve."
"I want to talk, Ebby," Dalinar said with a sigh. "I'm not actually sore."
"Oh."
She pulled her knees up against her chest. In here, she had undone and rolled back her safe hand sleeve, displaying her long, elegant fingers.
"Isn't this what you wanted?"
Dalinar said, looking away from the safe hand.
"You've been praying non-stop."
"For the heralds to soften your heart."
"Right. Well, they've done that. Here I am. Let's talk."
"No, Dalinar,"
she said, reaching across to fondly touch his knee.
"I wasn't praying for myself, but for those of your countrymen you are planning to kill."
"The rebels?"
"Men no different from you who happen to be born in another city. What would you have done had an army come to conquer your home?"
"I'd have fought," Dalinar said. "As they will. The better men will dominate."
"What gives you the right?"
"My sword," Dalinar shrugged. "If the Almighty wants us to rule, we'll win. If he doesn't, then we'll lose. I rather think he wants to see which of us is stronger."
"And is there no room for mercy?"
"Mercy landed us here in the first place. If they don't want to fight, they should give in to our rule."
"But..."
She looked down, hands in her lap.
"I'm sorry. I don't want another argument."
"I do," Dalinar said. "I like it when you stand up for yourself. I like it when you fight."
She blinked tears and looked away.
"Evie," Dalinar said.
"I hate what this does to you," she said softly. "I see beauty in you, Dalinar Kolin. I see a great man struggling against a terrible one. And sometimes you get this look in your eyes, a horrible, terrifying nothingness. Like you have become a creature with no heart, feasting upon souls to fill that void, dragging Painspren in your wake. It haunts me, Dalinar."
Dalinar shifted on the carriage seat. What did that even mean? A look in his eyes? Was this like when she'd claimed that people stored bad memories in their skin and needed to rub them off with a stone once a month? Westerners had some curiously superstitious beliefs.
"What would you have me do, Ebby?" he asked softly.
"Have I won again?"
she said, sounding bitter.
"Another battle where I've bloodied you?"
I need to know what you want, so I can understand."
"Don't kill today. Hold back the monster."
"And the rebels? Their Bright Lord?"
"You spared that boy's life once before."
"An obvious mistake."
"A sign of humanity, Dalinar. You asked what I want. It is foolish, and I can see there is trouble here, that you have a duty. But I do not wish to see you kill. Do not feed it."
He rested his hand on hers. Eventually, the carriage slowed again, and Dalinar stepped out to survey an open area not clogged by rock buds. The vanguard waited there, 5,000 strong, assembled in perfect ranks. Tileb did like to put on a good show. Across the field, outside a bowshot, a wall broke the landscape with, seemingly, nothing to protect. The city was hidden in the rift in the stone. From the southwest, a breeze off the lake brought the fecund scent of weeds and creme. Tileb strode up, wearing his plate. Well, Adolin's plate. Evie's plate.
"Right, Lord," Tileb said. "A short time ago, a large guarded caravan left the rift. We hadn't the men to besiege the city, and you had ordered us not to engage. So I sent a scout team to tail them,
Men who know the area, but otherwise let the caravan escape.
You did well,
Delanar said, taking his horse from a groom.
Though I'd have liked to know who was bringing supplies to the rift, that might have been an attempt to draw you away into a skirmish. However, gather the vanguard now and bring them in behind me. Pass the word to the rest of the men. Have them form ranks, just in case.
Sir? Teleb asked, shocked.
You don't want to rest the army before attacking?
Delanar swung into the saddle and rode past him at a trot, heading toward the rift. Teleb, usually so unflappable, cursed and shouted orders, then hurried to the vanguard, gathering them and marching them hastily behind Delanar. Delanar made sure not to get too far ahead. Soon he approached the walls of Rathalas, where the rebels had gathered, primarily archers. They wouldn't be expecting an attack so soon, but of course Delanar wouldn't camp for long outside either, not exposed to the storms.
Do not feed it.
Did she know that he considered this hunger inside of him, the bloodlust, to be something strangely external? A companion? Many of his officers felt the same. It was natural. You went to war, and the thrill was your reward. Delanar's armorers arrived, and he climbed out of the saddle and stepped into the boots they provided, then held out his arms, letting them quickly strap on his breastplate and other sections of armor.
Wait here,
he told his men, then climbed back onto his horse and set his helm on his pommel. He walked his horse out onto the killing field, summoning his shard blade and resting it on his shoulder, reins in the other hand. Years had passed since his last assault on the rift. He imagined Gavilar racing ahead of him, Sadius cursing from behind them and demanding prudence. Delanar picked his way forward until he was about halfway to the gates. Any closer, and those archers were likely to start shooting. He was already well within their range. He stilled his horse and waited. There was some discussion on the walls. He could see the agitation among the soldiers. After about 30 minutes of him sitting there, his horse calmly licking the ground and nibbling at the grass that peeked out, the gates finally creaked open. A company of infantrymen poured out, accompanying 2 men on horseback. Delanar dismissed the bald one with the purple birthmark across half his face. He was too old to be the boy Delanar had spared. It had to be the younger man riding the white steed, cape streaming behind him. Yes, he had an eagerness to him, his horse threatening to outstrip his guards. And the way he stared daggers at Delanar. This was Bright Lord Tanelon, son of the old Tanelon, whom Delanar had bested after falling down into the rift itself. That furious fight across wooden bridges and then in a garden suspended from the side of the chasm. The group stopped about 50 feet from Delanar.
"Have you come to parley?" called the man with the birthmark on his face.
Delanar walked his horse closer so he wouldn't have to shout. Tanelon's guards raised shields and spears. Delanar inspected them, then the fortifications.
"You've done well here. Pullman on the walls to push me off should I come in alone. Netting draped down at the top, which you can cut free to entangle me."
"What do you want, tyrant?"
Tanelon snapped. His voice had the typical nasal accent of the rifters. Delanar dismissed his blade and swung free of his horse, plate grinding on stone as he hit the ground.
"Walk with me a moment, Bright Lord. I promise not to harm you unless I'm attacked first."
"I'm supposed to take your word?"
"What did I do the last time we were together?" Delanar asked. "When I had you in my hand, how did I act?"
"You robbed me."
"And?"
Delanar asked, meeting the younger man's violet eyes. Tanelon measured him, tapping one finger against his saddle. Finally, he dismounted. The man with the birthmark put a hand on his shoulder, but the youthful Bright Lord pulled free.
"I don't see what you hope to accomplish here, Blackthorn," Tanelon said, joining Delanar.
We have nothing to say to one another.
What do I want to accomplish? Dalinar said, musing. I'm not certain. My brother is normally the talker.
He started walking along the corridor between the two hostile armies. Tanalon lingered, then jogged to catch up.
Your troops look good, Dalinar said. Brave, arrayed against a stronger force, yet determined.
They have strong motivation, Blackthorn. You murdered many of their fathers.
It will be a pity to destroy them in turn.
Assuming you can.
Dalinar stopped and turned to regard the shorter man. They stood on a too quiet field, where even the rock buds and the grass had the sense to withdraw.
Have I ever lost a battle, Tanalon? Dalinar asked softly. You know my reputation. Do you think it exaggerated?
The younger man shifted, looking over his shoulder toward where he had left his guards and advisers. When he looked back, he was more resolved.
Better to die trying to bring you down than to surrender.
You'd better be sure of that, Dalinar said. Because if I win here, I'm going to have to make an example. I'll break you, Tanalon. Your sorry weeping city will be held up before all who would defy my brother. Be absolutely certain you want to fight me, because once this starts, I will be forced to leave only widows and corpses to populate the rift.
The young nobleman's jaw slowly dropped.
My brother attempted words and politics to bring you into line, Dalinar said.
Well, I'm good at only one thing. He builds, I destroy. But because of the tears of a good woman, I have come, against my better judgment, to offer you an alternative. Let's find an accommodation that will spare your city.
An accommodation? You killed my father!
And someday a man will kill me, Dalinar said. My sons will curse his name as you curse mine. I hope they don't throw away thousands of lives in a hopeless battle because of that grudge. You want vengeance? Fine, let's duel. Me and you. I'll lend you a blade and plate and we'll face each other on equal grounds. I win and your people surrender.
And if I beat you, will your armies leave?
Hardly, Dalinar said. I suspect they'll fight harder. But they won't have me, and you'll have won your father's blade back. Who knows? Maybe you'll defeat the army. You'll have a better storming chance, at least.
Tanalon frowned at Dalinar.
You aren't the man I thought you were.
I'm the same man I've always been. But today that man doesn't want to kill anyone.
A sudden fire inside him raged against those words. Was he really going to such lengths to avoid the conflict he'd been so anticipating?
One of your own is working against you, Tanalon suddenly said. The loyal high princes? There's a traitor among them.
I'd be surprised if there weren't several, Dalinar said. But yes, we know that one has been working with you.
A pity, Tanalon said. His men were here not an hour ago. A little earlier and you'd have caught them. Maybe they'd have been forced to join me and their master would have been pulled into the war.
He shook his head, then turned and walked back toward his advisors. Dalinar sighed in frustration.
A dismissal. Well, there had never been much of a chance that this would work.
He walked back to his horse and pulled himself up into the saddle. Tanalon mounted as well. Before riding back to his city, the man gave Dalinar a salute.
This is unfortunate, he said, but I see no other way. I cannot defeat you in a duel, Blackthorn. To try would be foolish. But your offer is appreciated.
Dalinar grunted, pulled on his helm, then turned his horse.
Unless,
Tenelon said.
Unless? Unless, of course, this was really a ruse all along. A scheme arranged by your brother, you and me,
Tenelon said.
A false rebellion, intended to trick disloyal high princes into revealing themselves.
Dalinar raised his faceplate and turned back.
Perhaps my outrage was feigned,
Tenelon said.
Perhaps we have been in touch since your attack here all those years ago. You did spare my life, after all.
Yes, Dalinar said, feeling a sudden surge of excitement.
That would explain why Gavilar didn't immediately send our armies against you. We were in collusion all along.
What better proof than the fact that we just had this strange battlefield conversation?
Tenelon looked over his shoulder at the body of his men on the wall.
My men must be thinking it very odd. It will make sense when they hear the truth. That I was telling you about the envoy that had been here, delivering weapons and supplies to us from one of your secret enemies.
Your reward, of course, Dalinar said, would be legitimacy as a High Lord in the kingdom, perhaps that High Prince's place.
And no fighting today,
Tenelon said.
No deaths. No deaths. Except perhaps for the actual traitors.
Tenelon looked to his advisers. The man with the birthmark nodded slowly.
They headed east, toward the unclaimed hills,
Tenelon said, pointing.
100 soldiers and caravaniers. I think they were planning to stay for the night in the way stop at a town called Videliar.
Who was it?
Dalinar asked.
Which High Prince?
It might be best if you find out for yourself as...
Who?
Dalinar demanded.
Bright Lord Toral Sadius.
Sadius? Impossible.
As I said,
Tenelon noted,
best if you see for yourself. But I will testify before the king, assuming you keep your side of our accord.
Open your gates to my men, Dalinar said, pointing. Stand down your soldiers. You have my word of honor for your safety.
With that, he turned and trotted back toward his forces, passing into a corridor of men. As he did, Teleb ran up to meet him.
Bright Lord,
he said.
My scouts have returned from surveying that caravan. Sir, it
was from a high prince.
Undoubtedly,
Teleb said.
They couldn't determine which one, but they claim to have seen someone in shard plate among them.
Shard plate? That made no sense. Unless that is how he's planning to see that we lose, Dalinar thought. That might not have been a simple supply caravan. It could be a flanking force in disguise.
A single shard bearer hitting the back of his army while it was distracted could do incredible damage. Dalinar didn't believe Tenelon, not completely. But storms, if Sadius secretly had sent one of his shard bearers to the battlefield, Dalinar couldn't just send a simple team of soldiers to deal with him.
You have command, he said to Teleb. Tenelon is going to stand down. Have the vanguard join the locals on the fortifications, but do not displace them. Camp the rest of the army back in the field, and keep our officers out of Rathalas. This isn't a surrender. We're going to pretend that he was on our side all along, so he can save face and preserve his title. Orinar, I want a company of 100 elites, our fastest, ready to march with me immediately.
They obeyed, asking no questions. Runners dashed with messages, and the entire area became a hive of motion, men and women hastening in all directions. One person stood still in the midst of it, hands clasped hopefully at her breast.
What happened?
Evie asked as he trotted his horse toward her.
Go back to our camp and compose a message to my brother saying that we may have brought the rift to our side without bloodshed.
He paused, then added,
Tell him not to trust anyone. One of our closest allies may have betrayed us. I'm going to find out.
72. Rockfall. The Edge Dancers are too busy relocating the tower's servants and farmers to send a representative to record their thoughts in these gemstones. I'll do it for them, then. They are the ones who will be most displaced by this decision. The Radiants will be taken in by nations. But what of all these people, now without homes? From Drawer 417, Second Topaz. The city had a heartbeat, and Vale felt she could hear it when she closed her eyes. She crouched in a dim room, hands touching the smooth stone floor which had been eroded by thousands upon thousands of footfalls. If stone met a man, stone might win. But if stone met humanity, then no force could preserve it. The city's heartbeat was deep within these stones, old and slow. It had yet to realize something dark had moved in. A spren, as ancient as it was. An urban disease. People didn't speak of it. They avoided the palace. Mentioned the queen only to complain about the Ardent who had been killed. It was like standing in a high storm and griping that your shoes were too tight. A soft whistling drew Vale's attention. She looked up and scanned the small loading dock around her, occupied only by herself, Vatha, and their wagon. Let's go. Vale eased the door open and entered the mansion proper. She and Vatha wore new faces. Hers was a version of Vale with too large a nose and dimpled cheeks. His was the face of a brutish man Shallan had seen in the market. Red's whistle meant the coast was clear, so they strode down the hallway without hesitation. This extravagant stone mansion had been built around a square, skylit atrium where manicured shale bark and rock buds flourished, bobbing with life spren. The atrium went up 4 stories, with walkways around each level. Red was on the second, whistling as he leaned on the balustrade. The real showpiece of the mansion, however, wasn't the garden, but waterfalls, because not a single one of them was actually water. They had been, once. But sometime long ago, someone had mixed far too much wealth with far too much imagination. They had hired soulcasters to transform large fountains of water that had been poured from the top level, 4 stories up. They'd been soulcast into other materials right as the water splashed to the floor. Vale's path took her along rooms to her left, with an overhang of the first floor's atrium balcony overhead. A former waterfall spilled down to her right, now made of crystal. The shape of flowing water crashed forever onto the stone floor, where it blossomed outward in a wave, brilliant and glistening. The mansion had changed hands dozens of times, and people called it Rockfall, despite the newest owner's attempt over the last decade to rename it the incredibly boring Haddonal Keep. Vale and Vatha hurried along, accompanied by Red's reassuring whistling. The next waterfall was similar in shape, but made instead from polished, dark stumpweight wood. It looked strangely natural, almost like a tree could have grown in that shape, poured from above and running down in an undulating column, splashing outward at the base. They soon passed a room to their left, where Ishna was talking with the current mistress of Rockfall. Each time the Everstorm struck, it left destruction, but in an oddly distinct way from a high storm. Everstorm lightning had proven its greatest danger. The strange red lightning didn't merely set fires or scorch the ground. It could break through rock, causing blasts of fragmenting stone. One such strike had broken a gaping hole in the side of this ancient celebrated mansion. It had been patched with an unsightly wooden wall that would be covered with creme, then finally bricked over. Brightness Nananov, a middle-aged Alethi woman with a bun of hair practically as tall as she was, gestured at the boarded-up hole and then at the floor. "You'll make them match the others," Nananov said to Ishna, who wore the guise of a rug merchant. "I won't stand for them to be even a shade off. When you return with the repaired rugs, I'm going to set them beside the ones in other rooms to check.
Yes, Brightness,
Ishna said.
But the damage is much worse than I...
These rugs were woven in Shinovar. They were made by a blind man who trained 30 years with a master weaver before being allowed to produce his own rugs. He died after finishing my commission, so there are no others like these.
I'm well aware, as you've told me 3 times now.
Vale took a memory of the woman. Then she and Vatha slipped past the room, continuing along the atrium. They were supposedly part of Ishna's staff, and wouldn't be suffered to wander about freely. Red, noting that they were on their way, started to head back to rejoin Ishna. He'd have been excused to visit the privy, but would be missed if he was gone too long. His tune cut off. Vale opened a door and pulled Vatha inside, heart thrumming as, right outside, a pair of guards walked down the stairwell from the second level.
I still say we should be doing this at night, Vatha whispered. They have this place guarded like a fort at night.
The change of the guard was in mid-morning, so Vale and the others had come just before that. Theoretically, this meant the guards would be tired and bored after an uneventful night. Vale and Vatha had entered a small library lit by a few spheres in a goblet on the table. Vatha eyed them, but didn't move. This infiltration was about far more than a few chips. Vale set down her pack and rummaged until she got out a notebook and charcoal pencil. Vale took a deep breath, then let Shallan bleed back into existence. She quickly sketched Nananav from the glimpse earlier.
I'm still amazed you were both of them all along, Vatha said. You don't act anything like one another.
That's rather the point, Vatha.
I wish I'd picked it out myself,
he grunted, scratching the side of his head.
I like Vale.
Not me?
You're my boss. I'm not supposed to like you.
Straightforward, if rude. At least you always knew where you stood with him. He listened at the door, then cracked it open, tracking the guards.
All right. We go up the stairs, then come back along the second floor walkway. We grab the goods, stuff them in the dumbwaiter, and make for the exit. Storms. I wish we could do this when nobody was awake.
What would be the fun of that? Shallan finished her drawing with a flourish, then stood, poking Vatha in the side. Admit it, you're enjoying this.
I'm as nervous as a new recruit on his first day at war, Vatha said. My hands shake, and I swear every noise means someone spotted us. I feel sick.
See? Shallan said. Fun. She pushed beside him and glanced out through the cracked door. Storming guards. They'd set up in the atrium nearby. They could undoubtedly hear the real Nananav's voice from there. So if Shallan strolled out wearing the woman's face, that would certainly cause alarm. Time to get creative. Pattern buzzed as she considered. Make the waterfalls flow again? Illusions of strange spren? No. No, nothing so theatrical. Shallan was letting her sense of the dramatic run away with her. Stay simple, as she'd done before. Vale's way. She closed her eyes and breathed out, pressing the light into pattern, light weaving only sound, that of Nananav calling the guards into the room where she was lecturing Ishna. Why come up with a new trick when the old ones worked fine? Vale didn't feel the need to improvise, merely to be different. Pattern carried the illusion away, and the sound lured the guards off down the hall. Shallan led Vatha out of the library, then around the corner and up the steps. She breathed out stormlight, which washed over her and became Vale fully. Then Vale became the woman who was not quite Vale, with the dimples. And then layered on top of that, she became Nananav. Arrogant, talkative, certain that everyone around her was just looking for a reason not to do things properly. As they stepped onto the next floor, she adopted a calm, measured gait, eyeing the banister. When had that last been polished?
I don't find this fun, Vatha said, walking beside her. But I do like it.
then it's fun. Fun is winning at cards. This is something else. He'd taken to his role earnestly, but she really should look at getting more refined servants. Vatha was like a hog in human clothing, always grunting and mulling about. Why shouldn't she be served by the best? She was a knight radiant. She shouldn't have to put up with barely human deserters who looked like something Shallan would draw after a hard night drinking, and maybe while holding the pencil with her teeth. The role is getting to you, a part of her whispered. Careful. She glanced about for Pattern, but he was still below. They stopped at a second-floor room, locked tightly. The plan was for Pattern to open it, but she didn't have the patience to wait. Besides, a master servant was walking along. He gave a bow when he saw Nenanov. "That is your bow?" Nenanov said. "That quick, Bob? Where did they teach you that?" "My apologies, Brightness," the man said, bowing more deeply. "I could cut your legs off at the knees," Nenanov said. "Then maybe you'd at least appear properly penitent." She rapped on the door. "Open this." "What?" He broke off, perhaps realizing she was not in a mood for complaints. He hurried forward and undid the combination lock on the door, then pulled it open for her, letting out air that smelled of spice. "You may go do penance for your insult to me," Nenanov said. "Climb to the roof and sit there for exactly 1 hour."
"Brightness, if I have offended—"
"If?" she pointed. "Go!" He gave another bow, barely sufficient, and ran off.
"You might be overdoing that, Brightness," Vatha said, rubbing his chin. "She has a reputation for being difficult, not insane."
"Shut up," Nenanov said, striding into the room. The mansion's larder. Racks of dried sausages covered one wall. Sacks of grain were stacked in the back, and boxes filled with long roots and other tubers covered the floor. Bags of spices, small jugs of oil. Vatha pulled the door closed, then hurriedly began stuffing sausages in a sack. Nenanov wasn't so hasty. This was a good place to keep it all, nice and locked up. Taking it elsewhere seemed, well, a crime. Maybe she could move into Rockfall, act the part. And the former lady of the house? Well, she was an inferior version, obviously. Just deal with her. Take her place. It would feel right, wouldn't it? With a chill, Vale let one layer of illusion drop. Storms. Storms? What had that been?
"Not to give offense, Brightness," Vatha said, putting his sack of sausages in the dumbwaiter. "But you can stand there and supervise. Or you can storming help and get twice as much food along with half as much ego."
"Sorry," Vale said, grabbing a sack of grain. "That woman's head is a frightening place."
"Well, I did say that Nenanov is notoriously difficult."
"Yeah," Vale thought. "But I was talking about Shallan." They worked quickly, filling the large dumbwaiter, which was needed to take in large shipments from the delivery room below. They got all of the sausages, most of the long roots, and a few sacks of grain. Once the dumbwaiter was full, the two of them lowered the thing to the ground floor. They waited by the door, and fortunately Red started whistling. The ground floor was clear again. Not trusting herself with Nananov's face, she stayed Vale as the two hurried out. Pattern waited outside, and he hummed, climbing her trousers. On their way down, they passed a waterfall made of pure marble. Shallan would have loved to linger and marvel at the artful soul-casting. Fortunately, Vale was running this operation. Shallan got lost in things. She'd get focused on details, or stick her head in the clouds and dream about the big picture. That comfortable middle, that safe place of moderation, was unfamiliar ground to her. They descended the steps, then joined Red at the damaged room and helped him carry a rolled-up carpet to the loading bay. She had Pattern quietly open the lock to the dumbwaiter down here, then sent him away to decoy a few servants who had been bringing wood into the bay. They pursued an image of a feral mink with a key in its mouth. Together, Vale, Red, and Vatha unrolled the rug, filled it with sacks of food from the dumbwaiter, then rolled it back up and heaved it into their waiting wagon. The guards at the gate shouldn't notice a few extra bulgy carpets. They fetched a second carpet, repeated the process, then started back. Vale, however, paused in the loading bay right by the door. What was that on the ceiling? She cocked her head at the strange sight of pools of liquid dripping down. Anger spren, she realized, collecting there and then boiling through the floor. The larder was directly above them. Run, Vale said, spinning and bolting back toward the wagon. A second later, someone upstairs started shouting. Vale scrambled into the wagon's seat, then slapped the chull with the steering reed. Her team, joined by Ishna, charged back into the room and leapt into the wagon, which started moving. Step by protracted step. Vale, Shallan slapped the large crab on the shell, urging it forward. But Chulls went at Chull speed. The wagon eased out into the courtyard, and ahead the gates were already closing. Storms, Vatha said. He looked over his shoulder. Is this part of the fun? Behind them, Nananav burst out of the building, her hair wobbling. Stop them! Thieves! Shallan, Vatha asked. Vale, whoever you are, storms, they have crossbows. Shallan breathed out. The gates clanged shut ahead of them. Armed guards entered the small courtyard, weapons ready. Shallan! Vatha cried. She stood on the wagon, stormlight swirling around her. The chull pulled to a stop, and she confronted the guards. The men stumbled to a halt, jaws dropping. Behind, Nananav broke the silence. What are you idiots doing? What? She trailed off, then pulled up short as Shallan turned to look at her. Wearing the woman's face. Same hair, same features. Same clothing. Mimicked right down to the attitude, with nose in the air. Shallan Nananav raised her hands to the side, and spren burst from the ground around the wagon, pools of blood shimmering the wrong color and boiling far too violently, pieces of glass that rained down, anticipation spren, like thin tentacles. Shallan Nananav let her image distort, features sliding off her face, dripping down like paint running down a wall. Ordinary Nananav screamed and fled back toward the building. One of the guards loosed his crossbow, and the bolt took Shallan Nananav right in the head. Bother. Her vision went dark for a moment, and she had a flash of panic, remembering her stabbing in the palace. But why should she care if actual pain spren joined the illusory ones around her? She righted herself and looked back toward the soldiers, her face melting, the crossbow bolt sticking from her temple. The guards ran.
Vatha,
she said,
push open the gate.
Her mouth didn't work right. How odd. Vatha didn't move, so she glared at him.
Gah!
He shouted, scrambling back and stumbling across one of the rugs in the bed of the wagon. He fell down beside Red, who was surrounded by fear spren, like globs of goo. Even Ishna looked as if she'd seen a void bringer. Shallan let the illusions go, all of them, right down to Vale, just normal everyday Vale.
Is all right, Vale said. Just illusions. Go. Open the gates.
Vatha heaved himself out of the wagon and ran for the gates.
Vale? Red said. That crossbow bolt? The blood is staining your outfit.
I was going to throw it away regardless, she said,
settling back down, growing more comfortable as Pattern rejoined the wagon and scuttled across the seat to her.
I've got a new outfit almost ready.
At this rate, she'd have to buy them in bulk. They maneuvered the wagon out the gates, then picked up Vatha. No guards gave pursuit, and Vale's mind drifted as they pulled away. That crossbow bolt was getting annoying. She couldn't feel her safe hand. Bother. She poked at the bolt. It seemed that her stormlight had healed her head around the wound. She gritted her teeth and tried to pull it out, but the thing was jammed in there. Her vision blurred again.
"I'm going to need some help, boys," she said,
pointing at it and drawing in more stormlight. She blacked out entirely when Vatha pulled it free. She came to a short time later, slumped in the front seat of the wagon. When she brushed the side of her head with her fingers, she found no hole.
"You worry me sometimes," Vatha said, steering the chull with a reed.
"I do what needs to be done," Vale said,
relaxing back and setting her feet up on the front of the wagon. Was it only her imagination? Or did the people lining the streets today look hungrier than they had previous days? Hunger spren buzzed about the heads of the people, like black specks, or little flies of the type you could find sometimes on rotting plants. Children cried in the laps of exhausted mothers. Vale turned away, ashamed, thinking of the food she had hidden in the wagon. How much good could she do with all of that? How many tears could she dry? How many of the hungry cries of children could she silence?
Steady.
Infiltrating the cult of moments was a greater good than feeding a few mouths now. She needed this food to buy her way in, to investigate the heart of the revel, as Wit had called it. Vale didn't know much of the unmade. She'd never paid attention to the Ardents on important matters, let alone when they spoke of old folk tales and stories of Voidbringers. Shallan knew little more and wanted to find a book about the subject, of course. Last night, Vale had returned to the inn where Shallan had met with the King's Wit, and while he hadn't been there, he'd left a message for her. "I'm still trying to get you a contact among the cult's hires. Everyone I talk to merely says do something to get their attention. I would, but I'm certain that violating the city's indecency laws would be unwise, even considering the lack of a proper watch." Do something to get their attention. They seemed to have their fingers in everything in this city. Kind of like the Ghost Bloods, watching secretly. Maybe she didn't need to wait for Wit. And maybe she could solve two problems at once. "Take us to the Ringington Market," she said to Vatha, naming the market closest to the tailor's shop.
"Aren't we going to unload the food before we return the wagon to that merchant?"
"Of course we are," she said.
He eyed her, but when she didn't explain further, he turned the wagon as she directed. Vale took her hat and coat from the back of the wagon and pulled them on, then covered the bloodstains on her shirt with a light weaving. She had Vatha pull up to a specific building in the market. When they stopped, refugees peeked into the wagon bed, but saw only rugs, and they scattered when Vatha glared at them. "Guard the wagon," Vale said, digging out a small sack of food. She hopped down and went sauntering toward the building. The roof had been ruined by the Everstorm, making it a perfect place for squatters. She found Grund inside the main room as usual. She'd returned several times during her time in the city, getting information from Grund, who was the grimy little urchin she'd bribed with food on her first day in the market. He seemed to always be hanging around here, and Vale was well aware of the value of having a local urchin to ply for information. Today he was alone in the room. The other beggars were out hunting food. Grund drew on a little board with charcoal, using his one good hand, the deformed one hidden in his pocket. He perked up as soon as he saw her. He'd stopped running away. It seemed that city urchins got concerned when someone was actively looking for them. That changed when they knew you had food. He tried to look uninterested until Vale dropped the sack in front of him. A sausage peeked out. Then his dark eyes practically bulged out of his face. "An entire sack?" Grund asked. "It was a good day," Vale said, squatting down. "Any news for me on those books?" "Nope," he said, poking the sausage, as if to see whether she'd suddenly snatch it back. "I ain't heard nothing. Let me know if you do. In the meantime, do you know of anyone who could use a little extra food? People who are particularly nice or deserving, but who get overlooked by the grain rationing?" He eyed her, trying to determine her angle. "I've got extra to give away," Vale explained. "You're going to give them food?" He said it as if it was as rational as making kremlings fall from the sky. "Surely I'm not the first. The palace used to give food to the poor, didn't it? That's a thing that kings do, not regular people." He looked her up and down. "But you aren't regular people."
"I'm not." "Well, Muri, the seamstress, has always been nice to me. She's got lots of kids, having trouble feeding them. She has a hovel over by the old bakery that burned down on that first ever night. And the refugee kids that live in the park over on Moonlight Way. They're just little, you know? Nobody to watch for them. And Jom, the cobbler, he broke his arm. You want to write this down or something?"
"I'll remember." He shrugged and gave her an extensive list. She thanked him, then reminded him to keep looking for the book she'd asked for. Ishna had visited some booksellers on Shallan's orders, and one had mentioned a title called Mythica, a newer volume that spoke of the unmade. The bookseller had owned a copy, but his shop had been robbed during the riots. Hopefully someone in the underground knew where his goods had gone. Vale had a spring to her step as she walked back to the wagon. The cult wanted her to get their attention? Well, she'd get their attention. She doubted Grun's list was unbiased, but stopping right in the middle of the market and heaving out sacks seemed likely to incite a riot. This was as good a method to give away the food as any. Muri the seamstress proved to indeed be a woman with many children and little means of feeding them. The children in the park were right where Grund had indicated. Vale left a heap of food for them, then walked away as they scrambled up to it in amazement. By the fourth stop, Vatha had figured it out.
"You're going to give it all away, aren't you?"
"Not all," Vale said, lounging in her seat as they rolled toward the next destination.
"What about paying the cult of moments?"
"We can always steal more. First, my contact says we have to get their attention. I figure a crazy woman in white riding through the market throwing out sacks of food is bound to do that."
"You've got the crazy part right, at least."
Vale slipped her hand back into a rolled-up carpet and pulled out a sausage for him.
"Eat something. It'll make you feel better."
He grumbled, but took it and bit at the end. By the evening, the cart was empty. Vale wasn't certain if she could get the cult's attention this way, but storms did it feel good to be doing something. Shallan could go off and study books, talk plots, and scheme. Vale would worry about the people who were actually starving. She didn't give it all away, though. She let Vatha keep his sausage.
73. Telling which stories. I am worried about the tower's protections failing. If we are not safe from the unmade here, then where? From drawer 311, Garnet.
"Stuff it, Beard," Ved said. "You did not meet the Blackthorn."
"I did,"
the other soldier said.
"He complimented me on my uniform and gave me his own knife. For valor."
"Liar."
"Be careful," Beard said.
"Cal might stab you if you keep interrupting a good story."
"Me?" K Kaladin said, walking with the others of the squad on patrol. Don't bring me into this, Beard.
Look at him, Beard said. He's got hungry eyes, Ved. He wants to hear the end of the story.
Kaladin smiled with the others. He had joined the Wall Guard officially upon Elokar's orders, and had promptly been added to Lieutenant Noro's squad. It felt almost cheap to be part of the group so quickly after the effort it had been to forge Bridge 4. Still, Kaladin liked these men, and enjoyed their banter as they ran their patrol beat along the inside base of the wall. 6 men was a lot for a simple patrol, but Azure wanted them to stay in groups. Along with Beard, Ved, and Noro, the squad included a heavyset man named Alloward, and a friendly man named Vasilev. Alethi, but with obvious Thalen heritage. The two kept trying to get Kaladin to play cards with them. It was an uncomfortable reminder of Saw and the Parshmen.
"Well, you won't believe what happened next," Beard continued. "The Blackthorn told me..." "Oh, storm it, you're not listening, are you?" "Nope," Ved said. "Too busy looking at that."
He nodded back at something they'd passed. Beard snickered.
"Ha! Will you look at that roosting chicken? Who does he think he's impressing?"
"Storm and waste of skin," Ved agreed.
Cal grinned, glanced over his shoulder, looking for whoever Beard and Ved had spotted. Must be someone silly to provoke such a strong... It was Adolin. The prince lounged on the corner wearing a false face and a yellow suit after the new fashionable style. He was guarded by Drahi, who stood several inches taller, happily munching on some chowder.
"Somewhere," Beard said solemnly, "a kingdom is without its banners because that fellow bought them all up and made coats out of them."
"Where do they think up these things?" Vasilev asked. "I mean, storms. Do they just say, 'You know what I need for the apocalypse? You know what would be really handy? A new coat. Extra sequins.'"
They passed Adolin, who nodded toward Kaladin, then looked away. That meant all was well, and Kaladin could continue with the guards. A shake of the head would have been the sign to extricate himself and return to the tailor's shop. Beard continued to snicker.
"When in the service of the merchant lords of Steen," he noted, "I once had to swim across an entire vat of dye in order to save the prince's daughter. When I was done, I still wasn't as colorful as that preening Kremling."
Alloward grunted.
"Storming highborns. Useless for anything but giving bad orders and eating twice as much food as an honest man."
"But," Kaladin said, "how can you say that? I mean, he's light-eyed. Like us." He winced. Did that sound fake? "It sure is nice being light-eyed, as I, of course, have light eyes. Like you, my eyes are lighter than the dark eyes of dark eyes." He had to summon Syl several times a day to keep his eye color from changing.
"Like us?" Beard said. "Cal, what crevasse have you been living in? Are the Middlers actually useful where you come from?"
"Some," Kaladin said. Beard and Ved, well, the whole squad except Noro, were tenors. Men of the 10th Dawn, lowest ranking in the light-eyed stratification system. Kaladin hadn't ever paid much attention. To him, light-eyes had always just been light-eyes. These men saw the world very differently. Middlers were anyone better than 8th Dawn, but who weren't quite High Lords. They might as well have been another species for how the squadsmen thought of them, particularly those of the 5th and 6th Dawn, who didn't serve in the military. How was it that these men somehow naturally ended up surrounding themselves with others of their own rank? They married tenors, drank with tenors, joked with tenors. They had their own jargon and traditions. There was an entire world represented here that Kaladin had never seen, despite it residing right next door to him. "Some Middlers are useful," Kaladin said. "Some of them are good at dueling. Maybe we could go back and recruit that guy. He was wearing a sword. The others looked at him like he was mad.
"Calma, Kip," Beard said.
Kip was a slang word that Kaladin hadn't quite figured out yet.
"You're a good fellow. I like how you see the best in folks. You haven't even learned to ignore me yet, which most folks decide to do after our first meal together. But you've got to learn to see the world for how it is. You can't go around trusting middlers, unless they're good officers like the High Marshal. Men like that one back there, they'll strut about telling you everything you should do, but put them on the wall during an attack, and they'll wet themselves yellower than that suit."
"They have parties," Bet agreed. "Best thing for them, really. Keeps them out of our business."
What a strange mix of emotions. On one hand, he wanted to tell them about Amaram and rant about the injustices done, repeatedly, to those he loved. At the same time, they were mocking Adolin Colin, who had a shot at the title of best swordsman in all of Alethkar. Yes, his suit was a little bright, but if they would merely spend 5 minutes talking to him, they'd see he wasn't so bad. Kaladin trudged along. It felt wrong to be on patrol without a spear, and he instinctively sought out Syl, who rode the winds above. He'd been given a side sword to carry at his right, a truncheon to carry at his left, and a small round shield. The first thing the wall guard had taught him was how to draw the sword by reaching down with his right hand, not lowering his shield, and pulling it free of the sheath. They wouldn't use sword or truncheon when the Voidbringers finally assaulted. There were proper pikes up above for that. Down here was a different matter. The large road, it rounded the city alongside the wall, was clear and clean, maintained by the guard. But most of the streets that branched off it were crowded with people. Nobody but the poorest and most wretched wanted to be this close to the walls.
"How is it," Bed said, "those refugees can't get it through their heads that we're the only thing separating them from the army outside?"
Indeed, many of those they passed on side streets watched the patrol with outright hostility. At least nobody had thrown anything at them today.
"They see that we're fed," Noro replied. "They smell food from our barracks. They're not thinking with their heads, but with their stomachs." "Half of those belong to the cult, anyway," Beard noted. "One of these days I'll have to infiltrate that. Might have to marry their high priestess. But let me tell you, I'm terrible in a harem. Last time, the other men grew jealous of me taking all the priestess's attention."
"She laughed so hard at your offering she got distracted, eh?" Bed asked.
"Actually, there's a story about—"
"Calm it, Beard," the lieutenant said. "Let's get ready for the delivery."
He shifted his shield to his other hand, then took out his truncheon.
"Get intimidating, everybody. Truncheons only."
The group pulled out their wooden cudgels. It felt wrong to have to defend themselves from their own people. Brought back memories of being in Amaram's army bivouacking near towns. Everyone had always talked about the glories of the army and the fight on the Shattered Plains. And yet, once towns got done gawking, they transitioned to hostility with remarkable speed. An army was the sort of thing everyone wanted to have, so long as it was off doing important things elsewhere. Noro's squad met up with another from their platoon, with two squads on the wall for duty, two squads off, and two down here patrolling. They were around 40 strong. Together, the 12 men formed up to guard a slow, chull-pulled wagon that left one of their larger barrack warehouses. It carried a mound of closed sacks. Refugees crowded around, and Kaladin brandished his truncheon. He had to use his shield to shove a man who got too close. Fortunately, this caused others to back away instead of rushing the wagon. They rolled inward only one street before stopping at a city square. Syl flitted down and rested on his shoulder.
They look like they hate you."
"Not me," Kaladin whispered. "The uniform."
"What? What will you do if they actually attack?"
He didn't know. He hadn't come to this city to fight the populace, but if he refused to defend the squad... Storming Velalant is late, Ved grumbled. A little more time, Noro said. We'll be fine. The good people know this food goes to them eventually. Yes, after they wait hours in line at Velalant's distribution stations. Farther into the city, obscured by the gathering crowds, a group of people approached in stark violet with masks obscuring their faces. Kaladin watched uncomfortably as they started whipping their own forearms, drawing pain spren, which climbed from the ground around them, like hands missing the skin. Except these were too large, and the wrong color, and didn't seem human.
I prayed to the spren of the night, and they came to me,
a man at their forefront shouted, raising hands high.
They rid me of my pain.
Oh, no.
Syl whispered.
Embrace them. The spren of changes. The spren of a new storm. A new land. A new people.
Kaladin took Noro by the arm.
Sir, we need to retreat. Get this grain back to the warehouse.
We have orders to...
Noro trailed off as he glanced to the increasingly hostile crowd. Fortunately, a group of some 50 men in blue and red rounded a corner and began shoving aside refugees with rough hands and barked shouts. Noro's sigh was almost comically loud. The angry crowd broke away as Velalant's troops surrounded the grain shipment.
"Why do we do this in the daytime?" Kaladin asked one of their officers. "And why don't you simply come to our warehouse and escort it from there? Why the display?"
A soldier moved him, politely but firmly, back from the wagon. The troops surrounded it and marched it away, the crowd flowing after them. When they got back to the wall, Kaladin felt like a man seeing land after swimming all the way to Thalina. He pressed his palm against the stone, feeling its cool, rough grain, drawing a sense of safety from it, much as he would draw out stormlight. It would have been easy to fight that crowd. They were basically unarmed. But while training prepared you for the mechanics of the fight, the emotions were another thing entirely. Syl huddled on his shoulder, staring back along the street.
This is all the Queen's fault, Beard muttered softly. If she hadn't killed that Ardent...
Stop with that, Noro said sharply. He took a deep breath. My squad, we're on the wall next. You have half an hour to grab a drink or a nap, then assemble at our station above.
And storms be praised for that, Beard said, heading straight for the stairwell, obviously planning to get to the station above, then relax. I'll happily take some time staring down an enemy army, thank you very much.
Kaladin joined Beard in climbing. He still didn't know where the man had gotten his nickname. Noro was the only one in the squad who wore a beard, though his wasn't exactly inspiring. Rock would have laughed it to shame and euthanized it with a razor and some soap.
Why do we pay off the High Lord's beard? Kaladin asked as they climbed. Velalant and his type are pretty useless from what I've seen.
Yeah, we lost the real High Lords and the riots are to the palace, but the High Marshal knows what to do. I suspect that if we didn't share with people like Velalant, we'd have to fight them off from seizing the grain. At least this way people are eventually getting fed, and we can watch the wall.
They talked like that a lot. Holding the city wall was their job, and if they looked too far afield, tried too hard to police the city or bring down the cult, they'd lose their focus. The city had to stand. Even if it burned inside, it had to stand. To an extent, Kaladin agreed. The army couldn't do everything. It still hurt.
When are you going to tell me how we make all that food? Kaladin whispered.
Beard
looked around in the stairwell. He leaned in.
I don't know, Cal, but the first thing that Azure did when he took command had us attack the low monastery by the eastern gates away from the palace. I know men from other companies who are on that assault. The place had been overrun by rioters.
They had a soulcaster, didn't they?
Beard nodded.
Only one in the city that wasn't at the palace when it,
you know. But how do we use it without drawing the screamers? Kaladin asked.
Well, Beard said, and his tone shifted. I can't tell you all the secrets, but...
He launched into a story about the time Beard himself had learned to use a soulcaster from the King of Herdaz. Maybe he wasn't the best source of information.
The High Marshal, Kaladin interrupted. Have you noticed the odd thing about her shard blade? No gemstone on the pommel or crossguard.
Beard eyed him, lit by the stairwell's window slits. Calling the High Marshal a she always provoked a response.
Maybe that's why the High Marshal never dismisses it, Beard said. Maybe it's broken somehow?
Maybe, Kaladin said. Aside from his fellow Radiance Blades, he'd seen one shard blade before that didn't have a gemstone on it. The blade of the assassin in white. An honor blade, which granted radiant powers to whoever held it. If Azure held a weapon that let her have the power of soul casting, perhaps that explained why the screamers hadn't found out yet.
They finally emerged onto the top of the wall, stepping into sunlight. The two of them stopped there, looking inward over the flowing city, with the breaching wind blades and rolling hills. The palace, ever in gloom, dominated the far side. The wall guard barely patrolled the section of wall that passed behind it.
Did you know anyone in the palace guard ranks? Kaladin asked. Are any of the men in there still in contact with families out here or anything?
Beard shook his head.
I got close a little while back. I heard voices, Cal, whispering to me to join them. The High Marshal says we have to close our ears to those. They can't take us unless we listen.
He rested his hand on Kaladin's shoulder.
Your questions are honest, Cal, but you worry too much. We need to focus on the wall. Best not to talk too much about the Queen or the palace.
Like we don't talk about Azure being a woman.
Her secret, Beard winced, I mean, the High Marshal's secret, is ours to guard and protect.
We do a storming poor job of that, then. Hopefully we're better at defending the wall.
Beard shrugged, hand still on Kaladin's shoulder. For the first time, Kaladin noticed something.
No glyph ward.
Beard glanced at his arm, where he wore the traditional white armband that you'd tie a glyph ward around. His was blank.
Yeah,
he said, shoving his hand in his coat pocket.
Why not? Kaladin said.
Beard shrugged.
Let's just say, I know a lot about telling which stories have been made up. Nobody's watching over us, Cal.
He trudged off toward their muster station, one of the tower structures that lined the wall. Syl stood up on Kaladin's shoulder, then walked up, as if on invisible steps, through the air to stand even with his eyes. She looked after Beard, her girlish dress rippling in wind that Kaladin couldn't feel.
Dalinar thinks God isn't dead, she said, just that the Almighty, Honor, was never actually God.
You're part of Honor. Doesn't that offend you?
Every child eventually realizes that her father isn't actually God.
She looked at him.
Do you think anybody is watching? Do you really think there isn't anything out there?
Strange question to answer, to a little bit of a divinity. Kaladin lingered in the doorway to the guard tower. Inside, the men of his squad, Platoon 7, Squad 2, which didn't have the same ring to it as Bridge 4, laughed and banged about as they gathered equipment.
I used to take the terrible things that had happened to me, he said, as proof that there was no God. Then, in some of my darkest moments, I took my life as proof there must be something up there, for only intentional cruelty could offer an explanation.
He took a deep breath, then looked toward the clouds. He'd been delivered up to the sky, and had found magnificence there. He'd been given the power to protect and defend.
Now, he said. Now I don't know.
With all due respect, I think Dalinar's beliefs sound too convenient. Now that one deity has proven faulty, he insists the Almighty must never have been God? That there must be something else? I don't like it. So, Maybe this simply isn't a question we can ever answer. He stepped into the fortification. It had broad doorways on either side leading in from the wall, while slits along the outward side provided archer positions, as did the roof. To his right stood racks of weapons and shields and a table for mess. Above that, a large window looked out at the city beyond, where those inside could get specific orders via signal flags from below. He was sliding his shield onto a rack when the drums sounded, calling the alarm. Syl zipped up behind him like a string suddenly pulled taut.
"Assault on the wall!" Kaladin shouted, reading the drumbeats. "Equip up!"
He scrambled across the room and seized a pike from the line on the wall. He tossed it to the first man who came, then continued distributing as the men scrambled to obey the signals. Lieutenant Noro and Beard handed out shields, rectangular full shields in contrast to the small round patrolling shields they'd carried below.
"Form up!"
Kaladin shouted, right before Noro did it. "Storms, I'm not their commander." Feeling like an idiot, Kaladin took his own pike and balanced the long pole, carrying it out beside Beard, who carried only a shield. On the wall, the four squads formed a bristling formation of pikes and overlapping shields. Some of the men in the center, like Kaladin and Noro, held only a pike, gripping it two-handed. Sweat trickled down Kaladin's temples. He'd been trained briefly in pike blocks during his time in Amaram's army. They were used as a counter to heavy cavalry, which was a newer development in Alethi warfare. He couldn't imagine that they'd be terribly effective atop a wall. They were great for thrusting outward toward an enemy block of troops, but it was difficult for him to keep the pike pointed upward. It didn't balance well that way. But how else were they to fight the fused? The other platoon that shared a station with them formed up on the tower's top, holding bows. Hopefully, the arrow cover mixed with the defensive pike formation would be effective. Kaladin finally saw the fused streaking through the air, approaching another section of a wall. Men in his platoon waited, nervous, adjusting glyph wards or repositioning shields. The fused clashed distantly with others of the wall guard. Kaladin could barely make out yells. The drumbeats from the drummers' stations were a holding beat, telling everyone to remain in their own section. Syl came zipping back, moving agitatedly, sweeping one way, then the other. Several men in the formation leaned out, as if wanting to break away and go charging to where their fellows were fighting. "Steady," Kaladin thought, but cut himself off from saying it. He wasn't in command here. Captain Didenor, the platoon leader, hadn't arrived yet, which meant Noro was the ranking officer, with seniority over the other squad lieutenants. Kaladin gritted his teeth, straining, forcibly keeping himself from giving any kind of order until, blessedly, Noro spoke up.
"Now, don't you break away, Hid," the lieutenant called. "Keep your shields together, men. If we rush off now, we'll be easy pickings."
The men reluctantly pulled back into formation. Eventually, the fused streaked away. Their strikes never lasted long. They would hit hard, testing reaction times at various places along the wall, and they often broke into and searched the towers nearby. They were preparing for a true assault, and, Kaladin figured, also trying to find out how the wall guard was feeding itself. The drums signaled for the squads to stand down, and the men of Kaladin's platoon lethargically trudged back to their tower. A sense of frustration accompanied them. Pent-up aggression. All of that anxiety, the rush of the battle, only to stand around and sweat while other men died. Kaladin helped rack up the weapons, then got himself a bowl of stew and joined Lieutenant Noro, who was waiting on the wall right outside the tower. A messenger used signal flags to indicate to others down in the city that Noro's platoon hadn't engaged.
"You have my apologies, sir," Kaladin said softly. "I'll see it doesn't happen again."
It?
"I preempted you earlier," Kaladin said. "Gave orders when it was your place."
"Oh, well, you're quite quick off the cuff, Cal. Eager for combat, I'd say."
"Perhaps, sir."
"You want to prove yourself to the team," Noro said, rubbing his wispy beard. "Well, I like a man with enthusiasm. Keep your head, and I suspect you'll end up as a squad leader before too long."
He said it like a proud parent.
"Permission, sir, to be excused from duty?" There might be wounded that need my attention farther along the wall.
Wounded? Cal, I know you said you had some field medicine training, but the Army's surgeons will be there already.
Right. They'd have actual surgeons. Noro clapped him on the shoulder.
Go in and eat your stew. There will be enough action later. Don't run too fast toward danger, all right?
I'll try to remember that, sir. Still, there was nothing to do but walk back into the tower, Scylla alighting on his shoulder, and sit down to eat his stew.
74. Swift Spren. Today I leaped from the tower for the last time. I felt the wind dance around me as I fell all the way along the eastern side, past the tower and to the foothills below. I'm going to miss that. From Drawer 10-1, Sapphire. Vale leaned her head to look in through the window of the old broken shop in the market. Grund the urchin sat in his usual place, carefully stripping down an old pair of shoes for the hog's hide. As he heard Vale, he dropped his tool and reached for a knife with his good hand. He saw that it was her, then caught the package of food she tossed to him. It was smaller this time, but actually had some fruit. Very rare in the city these days. The urchin pulled the bag of food close, closing his dark green eyes, looking reserved. What an odd expression. He's still suspicious of me, she thought. He's wondering what I'll someday demand of him for all this. Where are Ma and Selland? Vale asked. She had prepared packages for the two women who stayed here with Grund.
Moved out to the old tinker's place, Grund said.
He thumbed upward, toward the sagging ceiling.
Thought this place was getting too dangerous.
You sure you don't want to do the same?
Nah, he said. I can finally move without kicking someone.
She left him and shoved her hands in her pockets, wearing her new coat and hat against the cool air. She'd hoped that Kolinar would prove to be warmer after so long on the Shattered Plains or Urethiru. But it was cold here, too, suffering a season of winter weather. Perhaps the arrival of the Everstorm was to be blamed. She checked in on Muri next, the former seamstress with three daughters. She was of second non, high ranking for a dark eyes, and had run a successful business in a town near Revelar. Now she trolled the water ditches following storms for the corpses of rats and kremlings. Muri always had some gossip that was amusing but generally pointless. Vale left about an hour later and made her way out of the market, dropping her last package in the lap of a random beggar. The old beggar sniffed the package, then whooped with excitement.
"The Swift Spren," he said,
nudging one of the other beggars.
"Look, the Swift Spren,"
he cackled, digging into the package, and his friend roused from his sleep and snatched some flatbread.
"Swift Spren?" Vale asked.
"That's you," he said. "Yep, yep, I heard of you. Robbing rich folk all through the city, you do. And nobody can stop you, 'cause you're a spren. Can walk through walls, you can. White hat, white coat. Don't always appear the same, do ya?"
The beggar started stuffing his face. Vale smiled. Her reputation was spreading. She'd enhanced it by sending Ishna and Vatha out, wearing illusions to look like Vale, giving away food. Surely the cult couldn't ignore her much longer. Pattern hummed as she stretched. Exhaustion spren, all of the corrupted variety, spinning about her in the air, little red whirlwinds. The merchant she'd stolen from earlier had chased her away himself, and had been nimble for his age.
"Why?" Pattern asked.
"Why what?" Vale asked. "Why is the sky blue, the sun bright? Why do storms blow or rains fall?"
"Why are you so happy about feeding so few?"
Feeding these few is something we can do.
So is jumping from a building, he said. Frank, as if he didn't understand the sarcasm he used. But we do not do this. You lie, Shallan.
Vale.
Your lies wrap other lies.
He sounded drowsy. Could Spren get drowsy?
Remember your ideal. The truth you spoke.
She shoved her hands in her pockets. Evening was coming. The sun slipping toward the western horizon, as if it were running from the origin and the storms. It was the individual touch, the light in the eyes of people she gave to, that really excited her. Feeding them felt so much more real than the rest of the plan to infiltrate the cult and investigate the Oath Gate. It's too small, she thought. That was what Jasnah would say. I'm thinking too small. Along the street, she passed people who whimpered and suffered. Far too many hunger spren in the air, and fear spren at nearly every corner. She had to do something to help. Like throwing a thimbleful of water onto a bonfire. She stood at an intersection, head bowed, as the shadows grew long, reaching toward night. Chanting broke her out of her trance. How long had she been standing there? Flickering light, orange and primal, painted a street to her left. No sphere glowed that color. She walked toward it, pulling off her hat and sucking in stormlight. She released it in a puff, then stepped through, trailing tendrils that wrapped around her and transformed her shape. People had gathered, as they usually did, when the Cult of Moments paraded. Swift Spren broke through them, wearing the costume of a Spren from her notes. Notes she'd lost to the sea. A Spren shaped like a glowing arrowhead that wove through the sky around sky eels. Golden tassels streamed from her back, long, with arrowhead shapes at the ends. Her entire front was wrapped in cloth that trailed behind, her arms, legs, and face covered. Swift Spren flowed among the cultists and drew stares even from them. I have to do more, she thought. I have to think grander schemes. Could Shallan's lies help her be something more than a broken girl from rural Yakaved? A girl who was deep down terrified that she had no idea what she was doing. The cultists chanted softly, repeating the words of the leaders at the front. Our time has passed. Our time has passed. The Spren have come. The Spren have come. Give them our sins. Give them our sins. Yes, she could feel it. The freedom these people felt. It was the peace of surrender. They coursed down the street, proffering their torches and lanterns toward the sky, wearing the garb of Spren. Why worry? Embrace the release, embrace the transition, embrace the coming of storm and Spren, embrace the end. Swift Spren breathed in their chants and saturated herself with their ideas. She became them, and she could hear it, whispering in the back of her mind. Surrender. Give me your passion, your pain, your love. Give up your guilt. Embrace the end. Shallan, I'm not your enemy. That last one stood out like a scar on a beautiful man's face. Jarring. She came to herself. Storms. She'd initially thought that this group might lead her up to the revel on the Oathgate platform, but she'd let herself be carried away by the darkness. Trembling, she stopped in place. The others stopped around her. The illusion, the Spren-like tassels behind her, continued to stream even when she wasn't walking. There was no wind. The cultists' chanting broke off, and corrupted Allspren exploded around several of their heads. Soot-black puffs. Some fell to their knees. To them, wrapped in streaming cloth, face obscured, ignoring wind and gravity, she would look like an actual Spren.
There are Spren,
Shallan said to the gathered crowd, using light weaving to twist and warp her voice.
And there are Spran. You followed the Dark Ones. They whisper for you to abandon yourselves. They lie,
the cultists gasped.
We do not want your devotion. When have Spren ever demanded your devotion? Stop dancing in the streets and be men and women again. Strip off those idiotic costumes and return to your families.
They didn't move quickly enough, so she sent her tassels streaming upward, curling about one another, lengthening. A powerful light flashed from her.
Go!
She shouted. They fled, some throwing off their costumes as they went. Shallan waited, trembling, until she was alone. She let the glow vanish and shrouded herself in blackness, then stepped off the street. When she emerged from the blackness, she looked like Vale again. Storms. She'd become one of them so easily. Was her mind so quickly corrupted? She wrapped her arms around herself, trailing through streets and markets. Yasna would have been strong enough to keep going with them until reaching the platform. And if these hadn't been allowed up, most that wandered the streets weren't privileged enough to join the feast, then she'd have done something else. Perhaps take the place of one of the feast guards. Truth was, she enjoyed the thievery and feeding the people. Vale wanted to be a hero of the streets, like in the old stories. That had corrupted Shallan, preventing her from going forward with something more logical. But she'd never been the logical one. That was Yasna, and Shallan couldn't be her. Maybe she could become radiant and... She huddled against a wall, arms wrapped around herself. Sweating, trembling, she went looking for light. She found it down a street, a calm, level glow. The friendly light of spheres, and with it a sound that seemed impossible. Laughter? She chased it, hungry, until she reached a gathering of people singing beneath Noman's azure gaze. They'd overturned boxes, gathering in a ring, while one man led the boisterous songs. Shallan watched, hand on the wall of a building, Vale's hat held limply in her gloved safe hand. Shouldn't that laughter have been more desperate? How could they be so happy? How could they sing? In that moment, these people seemed like strange beasts, beyond her understanding. Sometimes she felt like a thing wearing a human skin. She was that thing in Urethiru, the unmade, who sent out puppets to feign humanity. It's him, she noticed absently. Wits leading the songs. He hadn't left her any more messages at the inn. Last time she'd visited, the innkeeper complained that he'd moved out and had coerced her to pay Wit's tab. Vale pulled on her hat, then turned and trailed away down the small market street. She turned herself back into Shallan right before she reached the tailor's shop. Vale let go reluctantly, as she kept wanting to go track down Kaladin in the wall guard. He wouldn't know her, so she could approach him. Pretend to get to know him. Maybe flirt a little. Radiant was aghast at that idea. Her oaths to Adolin weren't complete, but they were important. She respected him and enjoyed their time training together with the sword. And Shallan? What did Shallan want again? Did it matter? Why bother worrying about her? Vale finally let go. She folded her hat and coat, then used an illusion to disguise them as a satchel. She layered an illusion of Shallan and her Hava over the top of her trousers and shirt, then strolled inside, where she found Dre and Scar playing cards and debating which kind of chowta was best. There were different kinds. Shallan nodded to them, then, exhausted, started up the steps. A few hunger spren, however, reminded her that she hadn't saved anything for herself from the day's thievery. She put away her clothing, then hiked down to the kitchen. Here she found Elokar drinking from a single cup of wine, into which he dropped a sphere. That red-violet glow was the room's only light. On the table before him was a sheet of glyphs, names of the houses he had been approaching through the parties. He'd crossed out some of the names, but had circled the others, writing down numbers of troops they might be able to provide. 50 armsmen here, 30 there. He raised the glowing cup to her as she gathered some flatbread and sugar. "What is that design on your skirt? It seems familiar to me." She glanced down. Pattern, who usually clung to her coat, had been replicated in the illusion on the side of her hava. "Familiar?" Elokar nodded. He didn't seem drunk, just contemplative. "I used to see myself as a hero, like you. I imagined claiming the shattered plains in my father's name. Vengeance for blood spilled. It doesn't even matter now, does it, that we won?" "Of course it matters," Shallan said. "We have Urithiru, and we defeated a large army of Voidbringers." He grunted. "Sometimes I think that if I merely insist long enough, the world will transform. But wishing and expecting is of the passions. A heresy. A good Vorin worries about transforming themselves."
"Give me your passion."
"Have you any news about the Oath Gate or the Cult of Moments?" Elokar asked.
"No. I have some thoughts about getting up there, though. New ones."
"Good. I might have troops for us soon, though their numbers will be smaller than I'd hoped. We depend upon your reconnaissance, however. I would know what is happening on that platform before I march troops onto it."
"Give me a few more days. I'll get onto the platform, I promise."
He took a drink of his wine. "There are few people remaining to whom I can still be a hero, Radiant. This city, my son,
Storms.
He was a baby when I last saw him. He'd be 3 now, locked in the palace."
Shallan set down her food. "Wait here."
She fetched her sketchpad and pencils from a shelf in the showroom, then returned to Elokar and settled down. She placed some spheres out for light, then started drawing. Elokar sat at the table across from her, lit by the cup of wine.
"What are you doing?"
"I don't have a proper sketch of you," Shallan said. "I want one."
Creation Spren started to appear around her immediately. They seemed normal, though they were so odd anyway, it could be hard to tell.
Elokar was a good man, in his heart, at least. Shouldn't that matter most?
He moved to look over her shoulder, but she was no longer sketching from sight.
"We'll save them," Shallan whispered. "You'll save them. It will be all right."
Elokar watched silently as she filled in the shading and finished the picture. Once she lifted her pencil, Elokar reached past her and rested his fingers on the page. It depicted Elokar kneeling on the ground, beaten down, clothing ragged. But he looked upward, outward, chin raised. He wasn't beaten. No, this man was noble, regal.
"Is that what I look like?" he whispered.
"Yes. It's what you could be, at least.
May I have it?"
She lacquered the page, then handed it to him.
"Thank you."
Storms. He almost seemed to be in tears. Feeling embarrassed, she gathered her supplies and her food, then hurried out of the kitchen. Back in her rooms, she met Ishna, who was grinning. The short, dark-eyed woman had been out earlier, wearing Vale's face and clothing. She held up a slip of paper.
"Someone handed me this today, Brightness, while I was giving away food."
Frowning, Shallan took the note.
"Meet us at the borders of the Revel in 2 nights, the day of the next Everstorm," it read. "Come alone. Bring food. Join the feast."
75. Only Red. 11 years ago. Dalinar left the horse. Horses were too slow. A misty fog blew off the lake, reminding him of that day long ago when he, Gavilar, and Satius had first attacked the rift. The elites who accompanied him were the product of years of planning and training. Primarily archers, they wore no armor and were trained for long-distance running. Horses were magnificent beasts. The Sunmaker famously had used an entire company of cavalry. Over a short distance, their speed and maneuverability had been legendary. Those possibilities intrigued Dalinar. Could men be trained to fire bows from horseback? How devastating would that be? What about a charge of horses bearing men with spears, like the legends spoke of during the Shin invasion? For today, however, he didn't need horses. Men were better suited for long-distance running, not to mention being much better at scrambling over broken hillsides and uneven rocks. This company of elites could outrun any harrying force he'd yet to meet. Though archers, they were proficient with the sword. Their training was unparalleled, and their stamina legendary. Dalinar hadn't trained with them personally, as he didn't have time to practice running 30 miles a day. Fortunately, he had plate to make up the difference. Clad in his armor, he led the charging force over scrub and rock, past reeds that released hair-like inner strands to shiver on the breeze until he drew near. Grass, tree, and weed took fright at his approach. Two fires burned inside him. First, the energy of the plate, lending power to each step. The second fire was the thrill. Satius, a traitor? Impossible. He had supported Gavilar all along. Dalinar trusted him. And yet, I thought myself trustworthy, Dalinar thought, leading the charge down a hillside, 100 men flooding behind him. Yet I almost turned on Gavilar. He would see for himself. He would find out whether this caravan that had brought supplies to the rift actually had a shard-bearer in its ranks or not. But the possibility that he had been betrayed, that Satius could have been working against them all along, drove Dalinar to a kind of focused madness, a clarity only the thrill bestowed. It was the focus of a man, his sword, and the blood he would spill. The thrill seemed to transform within him as he ran, soaking into his tiring muscles, saturating him. It became a power unto itself. So when they crested a hillside some distance south of the rift, he felt somehow more energetic than when he'd left. As his company of elites jogged up, Dalinar pulled to a stop, armored feet grinding on stone. Ahead, down the hill and at the mouth of a canyon, a frantic group was scrambling to arms. The caravan. Its scouts must have spotted the approach of Dalinar's force. They'd been setting up camp, but left their tents, running for the canyon, where they'd be able to avoid being flanked. Dalinar roared, summoning his blade, ignoring the fatigue of his men as he dashed down the hillside. The soldiers wore forest green and white, Satius's colors. Dalinar reached the bottom of the hill and stormed through the now abandoned camp. He swept past the stragglers, slicing out with Oathbringer, dropping them, their eyes burning. Wait. His momentum wouldn't let him stop now. Where was the enemy shardbearer? Something is wrong. Dalinar led his men into the canyon after the soldiers, following the enemy along a wide path up the side. He raised Oathbringer high as he ran. Why would they put on Sarius's colors if they're a secret envoy bringing contraband supplies? Dalinar stopped in place, his soldiers swarming around him. Their path had taken them about 50 feet up from the bottom of the canyon, on the south side of a steep incline. He saw no sign of a shard-bearer as the enemy gathered above. And those uniforms. He blinked. That was wrong. He shouted in order to pull back, but the sound of his voice was overwhelmed by a sudden roar. A sound like thunder, accompanied by a dreadful clatter of rock against rock. The ground quivered, and he turned in horror to find a landslide tumbling down the steep side of the ravine to his right, directly above where he had led his men. He had a fraction of a moment to take it in before the rocks pounded him in a terrible crash. Everything spun, then grew black. Still he was pounded, rolled, crushed. An explosion of molten sparks briefly flashed in his eyes, and something hard smacked him on the head. Finally, it ended. He found himself lying in blackness, his head pounding, thick warm blood running down his face and dripping from his chin. He could feel the blood, but not see it. Had he been blinded? His cheek was pressed against a rock. No, he wasn't blind. He'd been buried. And his helm had shattered. He shifted with a groan, and something illuminated the stones around his head. Stormlight seeping from his breastplate. Somehow he'd survived the landslide. He lay face down, prone, buried. He shifted again, and from the corner of his eye saw a rock sink, threatening to crush sideways into his skull. He lay still, his head thundering with pain. He flexed his left hand and found that gauntlet broken, his forearm plate too, but his right-hand armor still worked.
This was a trap.
Sadeus was not a traitor. This had been designed by the Rift and its High Lord to lure Dalinar in, then drop stones to crush him.
Cowards.
They'd tried something like that in Rathalas long ago, too. He relaxed, groaning softly.
No, can't lie here.
Maybe he could pretend to be dead. That sounded so appealing, he closed his eyes and started to drift. A fire ignited inside him.
You have been betrayed, Dalinar. Listen.
He heard voices, men picking through the wreckage of the rock slide. He could make out their nasal accent. Rifters.
Tanalon sent you here to die.
Dalinar sneered, opening his eyes. Those men wouldn't let him hide in this tomb of stone, feigning death. He carried shards. They would find him to recover their prize. He braced himself, using his plated shoulder to keep the rock from rolling against his exposed head, but did not otherwise move. Eventually, the men above started speaking eagerly. From their words, they'd found his armor's cape sticking out through the stone, the glyphs of the Koch and Linnel stark on the blue background. Stones scraped and the burden upon him lightened. The thrill built to a crescendo. The stone near his head rolled back.
Go!
Dalinar heaved with his plated feet and shifted a boulder with his still-armored hand, opening enough space that he could stand up straight. He ripped free of the tomb and stumbled upright into open air, stones clattering. The rifters cursed and scrambled backward as he leaped out of the hole, boots grinding against stones. Dalinar growled, summoning his blade. His armor was in worse shape than he'd assumed. Sluggish, broken in four separate places. All around him, Tanalon's men's eyes seemed to glow. They gathered and grinned at him. He could see the thrill thick in their expressions. His blade and leaking plate reflected in their dark eyes. Blood streaming down the side of his face, Dalinar grinned back at them. They rushed to attack. Dalinar saw only red. He partially came to himself as he found himself pounding a man's head repeatedly against the stones. Behind him lay a pile of corpses with burned eyes piled high around the hole where Dalinar had stood, fighting against them. He dropped the head of the corpse in his hands and breathed out, feeling... What did he feel?
Numb, suddenly.
Pain was a distant thing. Even anger was nebulous. He looked down at his hands. Why was he using those and not his shard blade? He turned to the side where Oathbringer protruded from a rock where he'd stabbed it. The gemstone on the pommel was cracked. That was right. He couldn't dismiss it. Something about the crack had interfered. He stumbled to his feet, looking around for more foes, but none came to challenge him. His armor? Someone had broken the breastplate while fighting him, and he felt at a stab wound on his chest. He barely remembered that. The sun was low on the horizon, plunging the canyon into shadows. Around him, discarded bits of clothing flapped in the breeze, and bodies lay still. Not a sound, not even crumbling scavengers. Drained, he bound the worst of his wounds, then grabbed Oathbringer and set it on his shoulder. Never had a shard blade felt so heavy. He started walking. Along the way, he discarded pieces of shard plate which grew too heavy. He'd lost blood, far too much. He focused on the steps, one after another. Momentum. A fight was all about momentum. He didn't dare take the obvious route in case he encountered more rifters. He crossed through the wilderness, vines writhing beneath his feet and rock buds sprouting after he passed. The thrill returned to urge him on, for this walk was a fight, a battle. Night fell, and he threw off his last piece of shard plate, leaving only the neck brace. They could regrow the rest of it from that, if they had to. Keep moving. In that darkness, shadowed figures seemed to accompany him. Armies made of red mist at the corners of his vision, charging forces that fell to dust and then sprouted from shadow again, like surging ocean waves in a constant state of disintegration and rebirth. Not just men, but eyeless horses, animals locked in struggle, stifling the life from one another, shadows of death and conflict to propel him through the night. He hiked for an eternity. Eternity was nothing when time had no meaning. He was actually surprised when he approached the light of the rift from torches held by soldiers on the walls. His navigation by the moons and stars had been successful. He stalked through the darkness toward his own camp on the field. There was another army here, Sadius's actual soldiers. They'd arrived ahead of schedule. Another few hours, and Tenelon's ploy wouldn't have worked. Dalinar dragged Oathbringer behind him. It made a soft scraping sound as it cut a line in the stone. He numbly heard soldiers talking by the bonfire ahead, and one called something out. Dalinar ignored them, each step relentless as he passed into their light. A pair of young soldiers in blue crowed their challenges until cutting off and lowering spears, gaping.
"Stormfather," one of them said, stumbling back. "Kalekin the Almighty himself!"
Dalinar continued through camp. Noise stirred at his passing, men crying of visions of the dead and of Voidbringers. He made for his command tent. The eternity it took to get there seemed the same length as the others. How could he cross so many miles in the same time as it took to go the few feet to a simple tent? Dalinar shook his head, seeing red at the sides of his vision. Words broke through the canvas of the tent.
"Impossible! The men are spooked! They... No! It's simply not possible!"
The flaps burst apart, revealing a man with fine clothing and wavy hair. Sadius gaped, then stumbled to the side, holding the flap for Dalinar, who did not break stride. He walked straight in, Oathbringer slicing a ribbon in the ground. Inside, generals and officers gathered by the grim light of a few sphere lanterns. Evie, comforted by Brightness Calamy, was weeping, though Iole studied the table full of maps. All eyes turned toward Dalinar.
"How?" Teleb asked. "Blackthorn? We sent a team of scouts to inform you as soon as Tenelon turned on us and cast our soldiers off his walls. Our force reported all men lost. An ambush."
Dalinar hefted Oathbringer and slammed it down into the stone ground beside him, then sighed at finally being able to release the burden. He placed his palms on the sides of the battle table, hands crusted in blood. His arms were covered in it too.
"You sent the same scouts," he whispered, "who first spied on the caravan and reported seeing a shard-bearer leading it?"
"Yes,"
Teleb said.
"Traitors," Dalinar said. "They're working with Tenelon."
He couldn't have known that Dalinar would parley with him. Instead, the man had somehow bribed away members of the army and had intended to use their reports to coax Dalinar into a hurried ride to the south. Into a trap. It had all been set in motion before Dalinar had spoken to Tenelon, planned well in advance. Teleb barked out orders for the scouts to be imprisoned. Dalinar leaned down over the battle maps on the table.
"This is a map for a siege," he whispered.
Teleb looked to Sadius. "We figured that the king would want time to come down himself. To, avenge you, Bright Lord."
too slow, Dalinar said, his voice ragged. High Prince Sadius proposed another option, Teleb said. But the king... Dalinar looked to Sadius. They used my name to betray you, Sadius said, then spat to the side. We will suffer rebellions like this time and time again, unless they fear us, Dalinar. Dalinar nodded slowly.
They must bleed, he whispered. I want them to suffer for this. Men, women, children. They must know the punishment for broken oaths. Immediately.
Dalinar? Ebby stood up. Husband? She stepped forward toward the table. Then he turned toward her, and she stopped. Her unusual pale westerner skin grew even more starkly white. She stepped backward, pulling her hands toward her chest and gaped at him, horrified. Fear spren growing up from the ground around her. Dalinar glanced toward a sphere lantern.